Welcome all.
I waited for you this time. I gave you all the play out that you needed.
It's what the music needs.
No,
it's what the show needs.
It's what you need. Really.
It's what the world needs.
I don't feel like it's, you know, necessary to do everything that you want.
I know you don't understand music that is melodic. And they can't just be cut off in mid-shriek, but, you know, this is what we're dealing with here.
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for a website that isn't working this weekend. Movies.com just does not seem to be functioning this weekend for anyone, not on the mobile, not on the on the regular computers that people have. I don't know what's going on.
It's probably your fault.
I'm sure. I mean,
I understand. You know what you did.
The burden of being the most important voice in contemporary film criticism can be crushing. And I know that movies.com might not be able to carry the weight of that. So that is, you know, what I am.
Uh-huh.
You're my sidekick.
Uh-huh.
Your name is Alonzo Duralde.
Yes.
You write scratchy little garbage scribbles for some dumb thing, and then on the internet.
I'm a
acting like a monkey.
I'm a pause this and hit you and come back and see how you like that. I am the film reviews editor for The Wrap,
yes,
and a film critic, one of the critics of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. So there,
we have movies to talk about this week. Mm-hmm. They are When the Game Stands Tall,
mm-hmm,
Sin City, A Dame to Kill For,
right,
If I Stay,
mm-hmm,
Love is Strange.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a little roundup of things that you
And the one I love.
Bothering me to what?
And the one I love.
Didn't you already talk about that?
No, we saved it for this week.
For
you.
Oh.
To see it.
I see. Well, it's not like we can really talk about it all that
well
much.
We'll talk around it.
So that, and I caught up on seeing A Most Wanted Man.
Mm-hmm. Finally.
And then Life Itself.
Yes.
And this is going to be an extra long episode because we're going to clear the decks.
Yes.
Of all the top 10 lists that people have sent us and all the letters that people have sent us.
If you are driving somewhere on Labor Day weekend,
you have an extremely long listening session ahead of you.
Yes.
Or you could turn us off in the middle of a sentence if you feel like it.
It's up to you.
Because maybe you'll be bored by it all after a while.
But we are catching up on letters because we are.
And this is the last podcast.
Our backlog.
Of the calendar summer.
Right.
Because September will happen while you are gone to...
Well, no, I return on August 31st,
yeah,
actually.
But you're doing... Okay, so what's happening is this. Tomorrow, you are leaving for the Venice Film Festival.
Correct.
In Italy.
Correct.
And while you are there, you are going to record a podcast.
That's my hope.
Is this going to happen?
It is my hope, depending on everybody's schedule. I can't guarantee.
Everybody?
Well, me and the other person.
Has he not committed yet?
No, he would like to do it, but again, we don't know what our schedule is going to be. So if we can make it happen, we'll make it happen. If not, when I return on Sunday the 31st, we will do a very jet-lagged Christmas, and we'll just do a podcast here.
Look, you promised me that I was going to have a week off.
I will do my best, but I'm not going to do one by myself. I have to...
Get it together
with
Mr.
I will.
You know who.
I'm trying very hard
get
to make
it happening.
Happen. But since we're not there yet, it's hard for me to say what's happening.
I need a break from being the most important voice in contemporary film criticism.
It's draining, I know. Poor you.
Really, no, the thing is that if I don't have to do a podcast, I can focus on getting this book more accomplished.
Okay, yes.
This book that I'm
need to get that
allegedly going to have finished by the end of summer. Now it looks like I will have it finished by the end of...
Fall?
Real summer? like when the last day of summer happens in September, like the third week of September, that's my new goal date.
Gotcha. So you're just moving equinoxes.
Yes. So, I mean, the end of school summer
All right.
We'll be gone by the time you're done.
I will do my best.
You're giving me a week off.
To do a podcast
without you. It's going to be so great to have a week off.
All right.
The listeners don't care. They don't care if I'm on this podcast.
Of course they do. You're the most important voice in film criticism today. I heard it from you.
I mean, yes, that's true. But it doesn't mean that...
they don't want to slum it with me sometimes.
Yeah. Fine. Just you. Remember how when I used to go visit Texas a lot and you would do it without me?
Yes.
That was great.
And you and Bibbs did a show while I was in Kosovo and you talked about Rockula.
It had to be talked about.
Apparently.
So we saw... Okay, let's... Wait. Let's get The One I Love out of the way first.
Right.
Because it's going to take... 1 minute.
Yeah, because we can't really tell you what it's about, except for the fact that it stars Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass as
and it's directed by a first-timer?
Yeah, Charlie McDowell, I believe, is a novelist. It's about an unhappy young married couple, and their therapist, Ted Danson, suggests that they take a weekend at this beautiful house, you know, somewhere in gorgeousness, California.
Yeah.
And then they discover that there is a guest house on the property, and each of them goes in on their own at different times and discovers something unusual. And that's really all we can tell you.
That's all that we can say.
It's a really...
15 minutes.
It is a movie that has a really great twist, and, you know, you'd think that M. Night Shyamalan had ruined twists forever, but no, he has not. This is a really cool one, and it actually has... metaphorical impact, and really you should just go see this movie or stream this movie because it is available streaming before anybody ruins it for you. We will not ruin it for you, I promise.
No, we're going to ruin other stuff for you,
yes.
But we're not going to ruin this because it's good. And 15 minutes in is when the twist happens, and then the remainder of the 90-minute film is them
coping with
figuring out what to do about the twist.
Right.
Most of it rang really true to me in terms of what it's trying to get across.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few clunky moments. And some confusion near the end.
Yeah, my one beef with this kind of movie is that if you're going to have a really wild twist like this, either don't explain it at all or have an explanation that is at least partially satisfying.
I was partially satisfied by the explanation.
For me, the little bit of explanation we got just raised more questions. And so I was not... I had a problem with that.
But I really...
But that doesn't negate all the other good stuff it does.
I'm a huge fan of Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah. I know you like Juliette Lewis, but...
On Mad Men.
Elizabeth Moss...
Wait, I'm getting to that.
Okay,
fine. I'm getting to that.
Okay.
The great contest of who... is the number one Scientologist.
Yes, thank you.
I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Moss. She can do so much with just her face.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't even have to talk. She can communicate things with a face. And she has been in some strange, not quite good films where she's the sort of spark of life.
Mm. Like what?
In the movie. What was the beat?
On the road.
On the road,
yeah. She comes in and screams at somebody. It was the best part of the movie.
Yeah, she comes in and screams at somebody about two-thirds of the way through On the Road, and then she's gone. But those 2 minutes
you know, neither
make you wish the entire film had been about her.
Neither of us have seen Top of the Lake yet.
Not yet. But I hear that's
because I've got too much work television to watch for to have pleasure television.
And I like Duplass. I think Mark Duplass is really great as sort of a, you know, schlumpy every dude.
He's kind of an MFA Bill Murray.
Bill Murray has never crossed my mind thinking about him, but I guess I understand what you're talking about. And so, yeah, I'm sorry. This is all we can say about this film.
Yeah.
You need to see it. It's weird, and we dig it.
Yeah, we recommend it, and we're not going to tell you much. But it is, like I said, it's on Amazon, it's on iTunes. So even if it isn't screening in a theater near you, it is available on your computer, if you're in the United States, I guess. And you should totally watch it.
Sin City. A dame, what kills you for?
Yeah. Yeah. This one. So, yeah, 9 years later, the Sin City sequel that I was not clamoring for, somebody might have been, I don't know.
I never clamored.
Yeah, and it's basically the same thing as the first one, only it's without the shock of the, hey, wow, look at that. Look at how they're making everything look like a comic book. And,
right.
And all the glass flying in slow motion and the rain and the things. It's like, yeah, it just... Oh, God, this is a dull movie. And it's a dull movie that has all these decapitations in it, and it has, like, you know, prostitutes in bondage gear and things that you would think would make a movie not dull, but nope, dull it is.
Except for Rosario Dawson in the bondage gear. It's pretty terrific.
I actually felt bad for Rosario Dawson in this one. I felt like, wow, they're just putting you in these outfits and not giving you anything else to do, not giving you a character.
Yeah.
There's not much for her to do. I felt like she was being exploited, frankly. The only woman, I think, who rises above the material by basically one-upping it is Eva Green.
Gosh.
She is like, oh, really? I'm playing this? Watch what I do. Watch me now.
Like the first one, it's a series of,
hard-bitten...
vignettes, really. I mean, they aren't even full...
These sort of stories that kind of bump up against each other.
Yeah, and it's this sort of achronological situation, not just within the film, but compared to the last film as well, because what you have in this film are characters who died in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And you're expected to figure it as either a prequel or as...
passive-aggressive ghosts.
Or as a story that simply happened some other time in some other...
Or someone's having a memory.
Sin City universe, yeah. Because Mickey Rourke was killed in the first film, and now he's back.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember.
They electric chaired him in the first
film.
So,
well, Bruce Willis dies in the first film, and here he's definitely a ghost, right? That was my impression.
Yeah, I don't know.
It
is about nothing, and
it's a collection of noir cliches.
Noir hasn't always been about nothing.
No, noir was very much about...
It was about something.
Yeah, post-World War II anxiety and, you know, a lot of
And in the 60s when Samuel Fuller came along, and his films were sort of a kind of... post-noir, I guess. Mm-hmm. But they were also reflective of a chaotic, you know, outside world.
Sure, a rot in American society or, you know... yeah, I mean, these were films that were about something. And this is just about hats and trench coats and boobs and cigarettes and rain.
Yeah, this is a costume party.
Yes.
It's not... I mean, you can tell that the actors are just doing this because... they want to be in a cool-looking Sin City film.
Right.
And because they get to, you know, behave like characters in a noir film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fun. That's a fun sort of game to play.
It's a Carol Burnett Show noir sketch.
Yeah, and so, unfortunately, this movie has absolutely nothing on its mind other than unhappiness. Now, I didn't know this when I watched the film, because I don't usually go back and look at much autobiography of creators before, you know, watching a movie. But Frank Miller has some issues.
Yes.
And now that I know what they are post-seeing this movie, I can't help but think that they sort of color the way he creates stuff now.
Yeah, but I mean, he's always had kind of a weakness for, you know, rainy streets and tough dames.
And I get that.
I'll tell you.
And that's a fine weakness.
Sure. Well, it's funny because you were watching the first film on cable prepping to see the second one, and I had already seen the second one. So I was just in the other room listening to it, and I realized if you don't have all the razzmatazz visuals, just listening to it from the other room, I was like, oh my God, this movie's terrible.
Yes.
That was the first one, and this one's even worse. You know, all the women are prostitutes, strippers who keep their tops on because Jessica Alba refuses to do otherwise.
Yes.
Or man traps.
Yes.
There is one middle-aged woman in the movie, and her husband can't cheat on her fast enough.
Right.
It's cretinous.
There is it cretinous or cretinous?
Either.
Sure, but
either.
The treatment of women in this film is exactly as it was in the first film.
Yeah. Appalling.
And like you said, Eva Green takes her role as the femme fatale and fatales it up.
Yeah.
You can say that our friend James Rocky, who was also a critic.
Who's been on this show.
Said that to be the best thing in a bad movie once would simply be bad luck. To be the worst thing in many
to
bad movies.
To be the best
movies,
thing in many bad movies.
To be the best thing in many bad movies speaks of poor judgment.
There is a pattern going on here.
Because she was the best thing in 300 Rise of an Empire.
Right. And for the same reason, right? That she was basically sort of out-camping the movie.
She was out-outrageousing the film.
Yeah.
And that's not hard to do when the films themselves are timid.
Yeah, they're lazy.
When they tell you they're going to shock you, when they tell you they're going to take you, you know, into the heart of darkness or, you know, the biggest war of them all or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they just don't. And it becomes quite easy for someone like Eva Green to show up and become the actual cartoon that the movie refuses to allow itself to be.
Right.
So she does that in this film. She stalks through every scene and rolls her eyes and mocks the camera and goofs on the other actors and exaggerates every action that she, you know, performs.
And proudly displays her perfect breasts.
And does the thing that the rest of the film is too afraid to do. Yeah. She becomes literally naked.
Right.
None of the strippers are naked. Yep. None of the prostitutes are naked.
You see more Josh Brolin
She's
than you
naked.
Do Jessica
well,
Alba.
No,
movie.
You don't.
Well, he has a, you know, he has that sort of male leg up thing going on, but
not even that. There are straight up moments when Brolin is meant to be naked, and there's a perfect, like, triangle of darkness in his genital area.
Okay, fine. But you see, like, his entire, like,
and his leg isn't even in the way.
His entire side, you know, that kind of thing.
It's like they have removed his peen.
I'm just saying.
And put, like, a digital black circle.
Maybe he got bitten by the strain and
what
it
I
fell
would
off.
Really like. Yeah. What I would really like is if they would just put black bars over people's stuff.
Like in storytelling. it would be racier.
That would be funny.
But you still see more of James Brolin than you do of Jessica Alba.
Well, yes, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bad film.
Yeah, it is, again, as I said before, for a lot of other films, much of this stuff would be forgivable if the movie itself weren't just so dull.
I also appreciate Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, no, he's...
I liked him in the first film, I like him in this film. I like Mickey Rourke because he's a monster face. And that is... And obviously this is a prosthetic situation.
Yeah.
But...
No, he brings depth to it, and he's always fun to watch. But I just, you know, Robert Rodriguez, this is now on the heels of Machete Kills, which was unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the first one.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're just going to phone in these sequels, like, why waste our time? It's depressing.
There's no reason for this to exist.
No.
And you should not see it, other than... On cable, just watch her. Watch Eva Green.
Yeah.
That's it. All right. If I stay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a movie that weirdly we've met in the middle, even though we were sort of at disparate ends as soon as it was over.
No, it's bad.
Well, yeah, no. Neither of us was ever defending it, but, like, you, I think, hated it more when it was done. And
I did hate it.
I was warmer towards it when it was done, and we've kind of met in the middle
you
of
cool, it. You cool that I... Like, my hate cooled a little bit. Yeah. It's mostly because I see what it was attempting to do.
Right.
And it grew to sort of think that it, although I do believe it failed to do what it wanted to do, it also succeeded on a base, low common denominator level.
Yeah. I think this is another case, like, Sin City, where an actress sort of elevates the material and, yes, and makes it worthwhile. In this case, Chloe Grace Moretz, who plays the lead. This is another YA adaptation about a young girl at death's door.
About death.
But she's not a
death.
Oh, death. She does not have cancer, unlike the girl from Fault in Our Stars. She has been in a car accident with her family. And as she lies comatose...
Completely insufferable family.
Yeah, well, more on them in a second. So while her body is in the ICU comatose, her spirit is wandering the halls of the hospital. And they, part of my problem with this movie is they never really quite established the ground rules of what's going on here. Because I've seen movies like Topper where, you know, people kind of come out of their body and then they go back in. But it's not like spirit Chloe has the option to just hop back into her body and bring her body back to life. So when she's yelling at her body to wake up, I'm thinking, who are you talking to? I don't get the parameters here. But anyway, so it's all told in flashback while the coma is happening, and you find out that, you know, she was raised by these two sort of like local rocker types played by Josh Leonard and Maria Ennis. And they're
the worst.
Their cool parents' credentials are established over and over and over again until you just want her to run off and like move into some nice Mormons or something.
I'll tell you what, this movie gets its Pacific Northwest down pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Because as cool former punk rock parents, they name check all the right people.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about the Wipers and they talk about Dead Moon. And those are, you know, the Wipers were more well known than Dead Moon, but Dead Moon is really pretty obscure. And so they just drop that name like it's nothing. And so it's a way, it's a secret code in a way to be like, see, these really are cool parents.
The fact that the opening scene takes place under the Dandy Warhol's Bohemian Like You should have been a tip-off,
Makes them uncool parents. It makes the music supervision of this film not anywhere nearly as cool as these parents are supposed to be.
Right, no, it's an easy one. I look, I like that song, so clearly something is wrong.
And here, the band that the rocker boyfriend of Chloe Grace Moretz has, they are completely run of the mill. You know,
standard garagey
pop songs.
Jason Mraz-y almost.
Almost, yeah. And about two-thirds of the way through the movie, you learn that Merge Records is going to sign them. And
you were like, no, they're not.
It's like, that's not going to happen. Merge is not signing you. You're not even as cool as the Arcade Fire. So,
anyway, so we learn about Chloe Grace Moretz's life story. She embraced the cello early on and became this prodigy and was always kind of shy and withdrawn from the world, but then adorable rocker boy just like, you know, sweeps her off her feet basically. Yeah. And they have, you know, big love and big drama and things.
And effortless virginity loss.
Yes, definitely.
Like she is like Lady Casanova during this sex scene. She's all like, first I'm going to kiss you here, and then I'm going to play you like a violin. Or I don't know what she says. Something almost as stupid as that. And the only reason you don't laugh out loud is because she's the one saying it. Yeah. She's better than everyone else in this movie.
Yeah.
Carries the whole thing on her teen shoulders.
Well, Stacey Keach is really good.
Stacey Keach comes in for what? Two scenes?
Something like that.
To give, you know, heartfelt speeches that are quite moving.
They are.
And so he's fine as well. It's just... there's a weird thing about this film where, you know, it's a teenage death fantasy. And,
yes.
And for most teenagers, you don't even have to be super goth about it. There is not just the fantasy of, oh, when am I finally going to have sex? The other fantasy is, what if I died?
What's the world going to be like? What will people say?
How could the world possibly go on without me?
Well, that's the fantasy of, you know, attending your own funeral that comes up in Fault in Our Stars or Huckleberry Finn, and you know.
There's also the fantasy of, what if my whole family died? Then I'd be completely independent. So it's this push and pull of, do you dare to dream about the taboo thing where, like, the people you love the most would really just all go away permanently forever? And
everybody would say, oh, you're so brave.
And everyone would tell you how brave you are, or you alone had the survival skills and the life spirit tenacity to hold on and live. And,
or the seatbelt, I don't know.
Yeah.
And but so, again, not knowing what is required for her to live or die, or if it's her choice or not her choice, that's a big problem for me in this film.
Yeah, same here. There's a title. In the title itself, there is an element of choice.
Yeah, if I choose to stay.
Yeah, and it suggests that, you know, well, if you're lucky.
Maybe I'll stick around.
Maybe I will stay. If I stay, things are going to be a lot different around
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
So it's going to start not, going my way.
It's not if I wind up staying, you know.
Yeah, the film doesn't explore that at all. It becomes very much a drama of will she or won't she wake up from this coma. There's a nurse at the hospital whose entire job, it seems, is to pep talk people in comas.
Whisper in their ear.
Other people are doing all these medical things around Chloe Grace Moretz, but this nurse is leaning in and whispering into her ears and saying, come on, baby girl, this is all up to you. And I'm like, wait a second, if it's all up to her...
What are the doctors doing?
If it's all up to her, why is soul or spirit Chloe Grace Moretz not making it happen? Like, why is she... Why does she keep, you know, shaking her body self?
Yeah, she doesn't
be like,
seem to be...
Come on, wake up.
She doesn't
wake
seem
up,
to be... She
up.
Doesn't seem to be hesitating
like,
about living, so.
I don't get, like, who's gonna make this happen? Who's gonna make her wake up?
I liked her chemistry with Jamie Blackley, who plays the rocker boyfriend.
I don't know. I think he's kind of a stick.
He's okay, but she makes him better, you know. I mean,
well, yeah.
One of the things I noticed in the movie, it's written by Shauna Grant. Is that her name? It's based on her novel.
Shauna something who wrote Whip It.
She wrote Whip It, but she also wrote What to Expect When You're Expecting.
I don't think that's her fault. I don't know.
Anyway, there was a stretch where there were just several scenes where the dialogue just felt really hokey, and I could feel myself disengaging. And then Chloe goes to see the band play, and the two of them, the way that she looks at him from the audience, the way that he looks at her from the stage, I was like, ah, okay, I get it. Like, that's what this relationship is. And that felt much more palpable to me than any of the blah, 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 blah that had preceded it for the last several scenes.
Shauna Cross,
thank you. Yeah. So this is, you know, not a perfect movie.
It's for teenagers. It is not for grown-ups.
But it's not... I liked it better than The Fault in Our Stars, because...
It's almost exactly the same.
It is almost exactly the same, except the boy is not...
In terms of how successful the film is.
The boy is not nearly as insufferable. Unfortunately, they
no, this boy does not have that air of
smug.
I know wisdom things.
Yes,
that I'm going to dole out to you like morsels
in
like
dribs and drabs,
little cookies that I'm going to give you. There's, my wisdom of life is going to be so delicious to
like
you,
like little wrapped hard candies.
Yeah.
Although I was annoyed by the fact that the Chloe Grace Moretz character, you know, so self-sufficient and talented and all this stuff, that so much of her decision of so much of what she's thinking about as she's trying to figure out what's going to happen
is based on this boy.
And I'm like, this is your high school sweetheart.
Rory Gilmore do this?
Exactly. No. You have a great cello career ahead of you.
Exactly.
So I'm well, Rory Gilmore, you know, stole a boat. She was capable of some dumb stuff too.
She was capable of occasional dumb things, which she then would regret and learn from.
Yes.
Although she did. Did she stick with Logan at the end of the show? Or did she dump him to go off and live her
life? I think she dumped him to go live her life. Because she basically goes off on the Obama bus with the press, right? I think she ditches
Logan. We got to rewatch every season.
We do. We have to watch Gilmore Girls again.
All the perfect details of that. I want to believe that she did dump him at the end.
Yes.
Because he was a tool.
And, you know, who knows? Maybe she wound up with Max Medina.
Rory.
Yes.
Winds up with her mother's ex-boyfriend.
Yeah, who was her English teacher. Says, Laurel, I didn't want him.
That's gross. No. She actually goes back and gets Jess.
Probably. Maybe she
Jess,
does get... Does she, does
last
she,
season, if you remember...
Yes, Jess turns out to be...
Turns up to be, like, fully grown up, not a pain in the ass anymore, like, super literary, just exactly what she ought to have.
Right.
No, like you're a good guy.
I think if she doesn't actually wind up with Jess, I think the implication was that she will or should or whatever. Anyway. Yeah,
Dina's too boring.
Oh, God. Totally. We digress. what else did this week
I was? Just, there have been, BuzzFeed has been doing so many of those, like, this thing about the Gilmore Girls.
How many Rory Gilmore books have you read, you know?
Not enough.
No, me neither.
How many, well, like, ranking all the male characters. I assume they're going to do ranking all the female characters eventually, unless this was just for, like, who's the cutest or whatever. Yeah, I don't know what the point was. Obviously, Jackson should have been number one on that list. And Gypsy will be number one on the lady list.
Heck yeah.
Because she's our friend.
That's right. We're biased. Okay.
The Love Is... Wait. If I Stay out of the way. I'm going to talk just for a second about the two that I caught up with.
Okay.
A Most Wanted Man.
Yes.
Which is the Anton, say his last name.
According to, this is a letter we'll be getting to, but one of our Dutch listeners says it's Corbijn.
Corbijn.
Mm.
I have always heard people say Corbin. But who knows?
If you had always seen people jumping off a bridge, would you do it too?
Maybe. If in there were a nice net. Or a big pillowy. A giant marshmallow thing. Like, if it was one gigantic marshmallow that I would land on and then I could eat.
Yeah, no.
I don't think there'd be some graham crackers
chocolate. I don't think you're jumping off the bridge into a s'more.
With it?
No.
I would like that.
Anyway, Anton Corbijn, what about him?
This is such a terrific movie. Mm-hmm. It's so tightly controlled, and it's about, as you mentioned before when you talked about it.
Yes.
Post 9/11 intelligence gathering and who's in control of it and how the branches of one government and multiple governments refuse to work together, or who cooperate and then refuse to work together.
Or conspire.
Who conspire against each other. It's so good. So smart, and so frozen cold.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman is incredible in this movie. He raises his voice one time. It's at the end.
Yeah.
And there's a reason. But the rest of the film, he's just sort of talking like this. I am German, you know, like, or,
I mean,
his name is Gunther.
Yeah, he's sort of part spy, but part bureaucrat.
Yeah. You know? Oh, man. The reason I felt the need to catch up on it in the theater is because you told me that visually it enhances your viewing if you will see it on a big screen.
Yes.
And it really does because Anton Corbijn's films are all they're beautiful to look at. I mean, and they deserve that big screen.
Sure.
Also, I had the perfect viewing experience for it. I have found my new favorite day and time to see a movie. This is not going to work for everybody unless you take a Ferris Bueller day. But holy cow, Monday morning. If you live in a city where theaters are open and screening films as early as 10 or 11 in the morning or even earlier, we in Los Angeles, we're spoiled because they'll start screening films in theaters at 9 o'clock in the morning here, depending on the film. You go Monday morning, you're going to have the whole theater to yourself. And that is really the best thing in the world.
Is.
It's just the greatest to be in a movie theater alone.
It's such a luxury.
Yeah. I went in, I bought my ticket, and I love to sit in the back row. The very back row is my favorite place to sit. Because I get the whole screen, I get my back against the wall, so any dangerous intruders who want to come to me. I have a long way. They have to come a long way to get to me, and I can formulate my plan. Also.
Of what? Soiling yourself?
Self-defense. Fisticuffs.
Perhaps if you run away more.
Brawling.
Yeah.
Karate.
Krav Maga.
Did you know that I am a karate chop master?
You are not a karate chop master, and you will not karate chop me.
The, also, the back row, ain't nobody ever put their feet on that seat that you're sitting in.
That's a plus.
No one's ever,
actually, that's not true.
Put their poop shoes all over the
I saw somebody putting their bare foot on an armrest in the back row of a theater once. I was like, ah! It's nothing sacred.
No. I'm talking about where your head is. On the head,
yes. No, totally.
You don't want the poop shoe.
I know.
On your, yes. On your face. It's not what you want.
Or in your hair.
And so I like to be in the back row. It's safest for when dangerous intruders come in.
Which it happens all the time in movie theaters in Los Angeles.
And also, no poop shoe. So that's my favorite place to sit. But, so when I get there, they're steam cleaning the back two rows. And they're drying them. They're blow drying them with the giant blow dryers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of me was happy.
Yes.
To know that they steam
clean. You like cleaning.
They steam clean the seats at the arc light. I didn't realize this, but they do it. And that made me very happy. To know that, you know, that happens. But
they're doing it during your movie.
Doing it right before my movie, and the seat was wet. It was still wet. It was going to take another hour or so to dry. And I was like, my ticket's for the back. And the cleaner guys are like, sorry, we're cleaning.
And I'm sure, as you're saying this, it's echoing off the ceiling of this otherwise empty auditorium.
Oh, and it was in the big house, too.
And you're all, you're my seat.
It was in a big, it was one of the big houses, too, where they seat like 300 to 400 people in the house. But I went down to like the fifth or sixth row. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of just ignored the fact that I had fecal matter all over my...
Well, had they already steamed those seats? Were they starting from the back?
I don't know what they were doing. I don't know how.
Maybe it was clean.
Maybe they had been there all night steam cleaning all the seats.
Yeah. Maybe those were the last two rows.
And in my fantasies, that's fresh. That's what was happening.
It had like a little paper band across it, sanitized.
Wouldn't it be great if that's what they did? Like if they steam cleaned them and put the little paper thing on it to know that you were the first person to use it after the cleaning?
I miss the paper band. They don't do that anymore.
No. So
our younger listeners don't even know what that means.
Such a good movie. Go see it in the theater if you can. Then I saw Life Itself, which I bought on Amazon and just watched on our TV about Roger Ebert. Also very good, moving. And the thing I learned the most, because I knew a lot about Roger Ebert's life already, and that he was, you know, a newspaper man and a, you know, Pulitzer Prize winner and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
I learned things about Gene Siskel that I never knew before.
That's some of the best revelations in this movie.
Here's so great. Siskel was a player.
Mm-hmm.
Before he got
married.
He was
a playboy, or operator type.
Literally a playboy. Like,
He hung out with Hef.
Before he got married and had children and settled down in Chicago, that dude was going to orgies at the Playboy Mansion. They have photographs of him in this documentary. He, in the grotto, with some other dude who more or less looks just like him, with the same kind of mustache, they are naked in the grotto, with this woman
under a waterfall
with a bunny, a Playboy bunny,
topless
woman who's also topless, standing right between them, and they're both looking down at her chest with that look like, stop taking this picture because we're fixing to get it on. You know, Sammy Davis Jr. was holding that camera
up to his one good eye.
It was about to get real at the Playboy Mansion. With Gene Siskel. And there's like pictures of him on the Playboy plane.
Mm-hmm.
And they all in that great early like 70s
leisure suits.
Leisure outfits.
Yeah.
He was getting it at the Playboy Mansion. He was dirty.
He and Chuck McCann.
Meanwhile, Ebert was just drinking all the time with other newspaper men.
Well, Ebert was also hanging out with Russ Meyer. And Russ Meyer's stable, Russ Meyer's repertory company, if you will.
Do you think he dated, like, Kit and Natividad, or...
I probably. I mean, from what I understand, that was what he was getting out of this. And apparently, they don't mention this in the movie, but legend has it that in addition to Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, that Roger also wrote, like, Up and a couple of other ones, pseudonymously. Really? Yeah.
Oh!
I don't know this for sure, but it's what I've heard.
That would be cool.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful...
Everybody in the 70s was having sex all the time.
No, it's a lovely movie, and it's moving, and obviously if you're a film critic or somebody that cares about film criticism or film, you know, it's hard not to be moved by it. I have to say I do find myself, because I'm not so close to the subject, because, like, oh, we were such great friends, but just from what we know about...
You had professional contact with him.
No, but that aside, just knowing what we know about his life as people who read him and stuff, it does feel like there are missing pieces in this movie.
Such as?
Richard Roper.
What about him?
Never mentioned.
So?
He was on the air with Roper almost as long as he was on the air with Siskel. He was on the air for 6 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't make any impression on me.
Well, you know, it just, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. I kind of feel like that. You know, Roger wrote a lot about his time. He did like a year of his studies in South Africa.
Yes,
which I think is, you know, part of what really kind of made him the way he was about racial issues and really kind of, you know, an advocate for stuff and talking about it in his work. That's not mentioned. I don't know. I just
proficient at yelling at me.
Exactly. For not liking Crash. So I don't know.
Yell at me because I didn't like Crash. He yelled at me because I made fun of Crash.
Yes, that's true. How dare you?
I was flippant about Crash.
Yes, but Crash deserved it. Crash had it coming.
And he was angry at me personally. About that.
But no, it is absolutely...
And I was thrilled. It's like, Roger Ebert is yelling
at my name.
Roger Ebert's yelling at me. He's so great. He wrote me on the Valley of the Dolls, and he is yelling at me.
So, no, I'm glad you got to see it, though.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. He was awesome.
Yeah.
And my other favorite thing in it was Jonathan Rosenbaum being just sort of peeved about everything.
Well, that's the thing. It's like there are we know older film critics who are not fans. I mean, they're Roger's peers, and they kind of think that he was sort of the
traitor in their midst.
Just sort of the glad handy TV guy who sort of dumbed down, you know, what they do.
No, I know.
Mainstreamed it too much, and you know,
all he did.
A case could be made, but you know,
I don't think a case can be made. I think there is a kind of populism that, if you know how to use it properly, can just be another tool in your arsenal.
True. I think he did use his powers for good more often than not.
What do you tell me all the time about me? You tell me all the time that my tastes are esoteric, but that my way of communicating those tastes is so lowbrow as to make people think that I'm a clown most of the time.
I don't say it insultingly.
I know, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so it's...
You write about the Touring Horse in a way that makes people want to see the Touring Horse who would never, ever want to see the Touring Horse.
And then they're angry at me because I made them watch it.
Oh, exactly. But like, Siskel and Ebert made people want to see My Dinner with Andre. I think you're right.
There's a way... Like, if you read Jonathan Rosenbaum, and I do because I think he's one of the best film critics in the world, and I'm a huge fan of his work, he can be a tough read.
Yeah.
You know, he's not out to make friends.
He's rigorous.
With his writing. He's not out to be in USA Today or, you know, anywhere, really. He's the guy you read in Art Forum or Film Comment or on his own site or, you know, somewhere else. You know, that's the kind of writer he is, and he's serious about it. and you better take him seriously.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of different ways to write about film.
I think that maybe
Ebert did it his way, and he got on TV and made some blank.
Yeah, I will say that
makes people angry.
I think that through no fault of his own and no desire to do so, Ebert opened the door for a certain dumbing down of film criticism. Again,
he opened the door, but he didn't make everybody walk through it, drooling and
again,
stuff like that.
Not his intention to do so. And if it hadn't been him, maybe somebody else would have.
Right.
But I think, especially that whole the thumbs up, thumbs down,
yes,
dichotomy. You know, yes, the binary. That was a. But whatever. I'm nitpicking. Obviously, Ebert was hugely influential to me, and you know, meant a lot to a lot of people, and I think really opened up the idea of film criticism to a lot of people who maybe never quite grasped what it was, or thought about it, or cared about it. And the movie captures that really well.
Love is Strange.
Mm-hmm. Which I saw at Sundance this year, and then I wanted to see it again with you.
Yes. Because you're so in love with me.
Sure.
Because I'm the greatest thing that ever happened to you.
Yeah.
Because I made your life perfect and gave it meaning.
Now you're getting ridiculous.
Because you wouldn't want to, your life would suck without me.
Probably Kelly Clarkson. So, yeah, so it's Iris Axe's new film.
Because I'm the love of your life.
Okay, really, you can stop now. Could not be more...
Sorry, Bibbs. You thought you were.
I know. It could not be more different than Saxe's previous film, Keep the Lights On.
Indeed.
Which was about, you know...
People who should break up.
A horribly dysfunctional couple and, you know, the...
This is about people who should not break up.
Exactly, but who are forcibly separated.
Forcibly separated, yeah. Alfred Molina and John Lithgow play an old gay couple.
Lithgow's character is 71 and Molina's is in his 60s, I guess.
And they've been together for 39 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they live in Manhattan, and they get married because it becomes legal in New York, and almost immediately, Molina is fired from his job teaching music at a Catholic high school.
And it's legal, folks.
Because the diocese finds out that he got married and is marrying a dude.
Even though they all knew for ages.
Well, the school itself knew he was gay.
Yes.
And that he lived with Lithgow.
Yeah.
But they
this sort of public display.
They didn't care, yeah. But when there was when it was made public, and they got married,
yeah,
the diocese was like, "How come you haven't fired this guy years ago?" And they were like, "Oh, dang, okay." So then they fire him.
So that
this causes them to have to move
out of their co-op.
Out of their co-op because they can't afford it anymore. They have to sell it. And in the process of looking for a new apartment and selling the old one, they have to go live with family and friends separately.
Yeah.
Family and friends who, by the way, I must say, are all kinds of pain in the ass. Like, it's this is intentional. You know, at the very beginning, you see everyone celebrating them and loving them, and they're at the wedding reception, and Marissa Tomei is giving this sort of self-involved speech about how great they are.
That's also about her.
That's also kind of about her. And just by way of digression, I love Marissa Tomei so much. She's as good as Gamera.
She is.
She will always be as good as Gamera. As soon as the bad times come, as soon as they need their family and friends, the family and friends are all like, could you, I don't know, well,
Well, he's got... Okay,
maybe you could go stay in a hotel. Like, it's not... They're not cool. But they do go live with the family and the friends.
Yeah, and they come together. Lithgow's niece offers to put them both up at her house in Poughkeepsie. But
which
that's
is far too long away.
It's like an hour and a half out of the city, and that's not going to work because they... You know, Melina's got to find another job, and they've got to look for another apartment.
Yes.
So Lithgow winds up going to live with his nephew, Darren Burroughs, who's married to Marissa Tomei. And winds up sharing a bunk bed with their, like, teenage son. While Melina goes downstairs and sleeps on the sofa of the gay cops, played by Cheyenne Jackson and
some guy.
I forget the other gentleman's name.
Whose face I know and whose name I can never remember.
And so, you know, that thing about, you know, guests like fish begin to stink after 3 days. And it's just...
The guests don't begin to stink.
Well,
the hosts stink from the beginning.
Well, Lithgow can be a handful, but it's also Marissa Tomei's fault for not telling him, "Hey, I need some quiet time. I'm a writer. Shut up, old man."
Yeah.
So it's awkward for everybody. And what's so great about how Melina and Lithgow play the couple when they're together. You totally buy them. I mean, just the way they stand together in a kitchen, the way they look at each other and touch each other, just you get the feeling is, yes, these guys have been together for decades. And then when they're apart, you sense the other half missing, you know?
Yeah.
And
yes.
And to for an actor to portray an absence like that, it's really skillful. And so you can tell how incomplete they are without each other in the moments they're apart. And there's this great scene where you know, in the middle of yet another loud party at the cop's house, like, Melina just trudges over to Marissa Tomei's apartment in the rain just to, like, hug him because he just can't take it.
Manny Perez. Who's been in a million things.
Yeah.
70% of which he plays policeman.
Okay.
That's pretty much. So,
It's a beautiful film and really well done and smart. My only qualm is that the plot stuff is solved almost magically. to me, I mean, for
I don't
me,
know that I agree with you.
For
on
me,
that.
As a non-New Yorker, maybe this sort of thing happens in New York, and it's a thing that happens. But that just felt a little too convenient. But everything else in the movie is wonderfully complicated and human and not tidy, and I like that a lot.
It looks really good,
yeah.
As well. I'm blanking on the cinematographer's name. But there's a very naturalistic quality to the filmmaking. Nothing is showy. The camera lingers on human details that you might not otherwise get from a different kind of filmmaker. And there is just a lot of goodness on the part of these two men. And a lot of tenderness.
The cinematographer's name is Christos Voudouris.
Okay.
He shot Alps.
Oh. I love Alps.
You like it. He shot Before Midnight. So.
Right on.
Yeah, he's a dude.
This is a lovely film.
Yes. It opened this weekend in New York and LA. It is expanding wider.
And it says a lot about... Unfortunately, you won't maybe get this if you're straight. Not that you won't get the film, but there are elements of the film that I think you might not get if you're straight. If you are gay, you'll pick up on stuff that other people will not. Especially the idea that your very being, every move you make in life, is being scrutinized by someone.
Is subject to approval.
And is subject to their approval or disapproval, or their assumption that it's their place to tell you whether or not you are appropriate or not for any given situation. The idea that any human interaction you have with any other human of your own gender is colored by the fact that obviously, somewhere deep down, you are the kind of predator that they have always heard you are.
Right.
Not you personally, but you, the gay.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting.
There's also a conversation with the teenagers about how gay just means stupid.
Yeah. And that is accepted by the heterosexual adults.
Yes.
As, Don't you be offended yeah, by this thing that is offensive. It's just teen
slang, you know.
I mean, and I'm not...
You love saying gay is stupid.
I love saying gay as a thing that is stupid, but that's just because I'm horrible.
Yes.
Not because I philosophically stand by my own behavior. So, it's just... it's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you get a chance, do.
Yeah, it's probably one of my favorite movies this year.
DVD picks.
Well, since Alfred Molina plays half of a gay couple in Love is Strange, I thought I would go back to his screen debut where he played half of a gay couple in Prick Up Your Ears.
That movie wigged me out when I was a young man seeing it for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, I'd never seen that sort of brazen gay sexuality in a regular movie before.
No, me neither. Please. I sat there still in the closet sitting next to Kurt Holman
freaking
with
out.
My head exploding and hoping he wasn't noticing.
Yeah. I saw it with friends too.
Yeah.
When I was not out yet. I was in my early 20s, I guess. And still just completely closeted. And I remember just being like, oh my God. First of all, I remember being horrified by, is that how gays go find sex? Like, because Joe Wharton was a dirty man. Like, he would go get it anywhere he could. It was very much a taxi zoom glow kind of thing.
He liked a public toilet.
Yeah, and I just thought, is that what it is? Is that how it goes? Oh God, I'm not going anywhere near this ever in my life. And, but then at the same time, of course, it's real dirty and sexy. And you're like, oh, I don't know, maybe.
Anyway, Alfred Molina, Gary Oldman stars as playwright Joe Wharton, Alfred Molina as his dissatisfied, frustrated,
very artist, dissatisfied, very frustrated
lover. Oh God, now I'm forgetting his name. Oh, I feel terrible.
Why don't you do your homework?
No, I know. It's like forgetting Salieri's name. This guy deserves a little credit. Anyway, you tell yours, and I'll get back to mine.
Kenneth Halliwell.
Kenneth Halliwell, thank you.
Yeah.
And Molina is great in it, and so is Oldman, and so is Vanessa Redgrave as Orton's agent, and Wallace Shawn as John Lahr, who wrote the book of the same name. Who I think is still reviewing theater for, like, The New Yorker or somebody.
John Lahr?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bert Lahr's grandson or something.
Son or grandson, yeah.
So he's old now. The Dance of Reality comes out on DVD this week.
Mm-hmm.
The latest Jodorowsky film.
Jodorowsky? I don't even know.
Great Chilean filmmaker. And it's his
best known for El Topo and the Holy Mountain.
And
Santa Sangre.
Could possibly be his last movie, unless he lives another, 10, 15, 20 years, which is entirely possible. Manuel de Oliveira, he's over 100. He was still cranking them out. Is he dead yet?
De Oliveira, no. Yeah,
are you sure?
Yes. We'd have heard. Big year for Jodorowsky or Jodorowsky or however you say it, because there was the Jodorowsky's Dune documentary this year about his adaptation of the Frank Herbert novel that was never made, and then he turns
Manuel
around.
Manuel de Oliveira is 105, and he's going to make another movie.
Of course he is. And then Jodorowsky turns around and unveils his own new movie this year, which I did not see, but you were raving about.
Yes, it's another autobiographical film, and it's completely, full of poetic imagery and metaphor and symbol. It is
surreal in the correct
use of the
word. And his son plays him?
His son plays him. His son plays the father of little.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. And, the mother character, every time she opens her mouth to speak, she sings her dialogue operatically. It is a strange and beautiful, and seeing it once was not enough. I want to see it again.
Okay.
It's also the most sort of generous and I guess contented may not be the right word, but loving of his films, because he's sort of looking back on his whole life and sort of taking stock and sure. You know, everything turned out great for him.
So, what's to complain?
Yeah. So it's lovely. It's one of my favorite movies of this year. I did not write about it because I saw it sort of a few weeks after its release. And so I was just like, I'll just talk about it here. When the DVD comes out and boom, here it is. So that's my pick. All right. Now, if you are not a fan of the letters that people send, you could turn off the podcast right now because we're going to clear the decks of all the letters that have been building up all summer long. I don't know how long this is going to take, but we're going
to
do it.
Thus leaving us with an empty mailbag for you to fill come autumn. So yes. If you've been sitting on an idea for a top 10 list or something, or hedging your bets about writing a letter, now's the time to do it, because we start from scratch all over again in a couple weeks.
Hello, Alonzo and Dave. This letter is in response to the varied reactions y'all gave to Monica Mana on the previous show. Anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, Monica Mana is an ethnographic documentary about people in Nepal taking a cable car up to the top of a mountain to a shrine where they worship a Hindu goddess.
But the whole movie is set inside the cable car. The
entire film is set inside these series of cable cars. It's one cable car, but different passengers get in and get out.
Right.
There is another cable car that the camera is set up in as well. It's a cargo cable car. And that trip, that 11-minute trip, which is the length of a roll of 16-millimeter film, and that is why they chose that amount of time, because that's how long it takes to get from the bottom to the top of the mountain, so it became sort of like this serendipitous thing. As they shot on 16-millimeter film, not digitally at all, they put the camera in the goat container. So for 11 minutes, you're watching goats.
Yes.
And it's incredible.
One of whom has his ass to the camera.
Perfect butthole in the middle of the screen.
Kubrick would be proud.
Yes. Full disclosure that I have not yet seen the film, but it honestly seems like something I could really be into. I understand that this is probably not the type of movie I'd want to watch after a long day at the office either, which is how I took you to see it. I saw it a second time, and on the second time, I took Alonzo to see the film after he had been in the office all day. And I refused to tell him anything about the movie because I didn't want him to go, no, I'm not going to see that. Not the type of movie I'd want to watch after a long day at the office either, but where I find the assessment of this film somewhat problematic is where Alonzo says 2 hours of ethnography as if that's inherently a bad thing or not something you would want to sit through. Hang on, let me finish reading the letter before you lambaste, I can't remember. I don't want to make any assumptions about anyone's taste. But here it goes. But I just want to pose a general question, because it's one I've been thinking about a lot lately myself. Why do y'all think that there is a general distaste for lengthy, steadily paced films or, quote, slow cinema amongst not only the general movie-going public, but also when it comes to film nerds? For example, I can't count the number of times I've heard self-professed movie fans call The Tree of Life indulgent nonsense, or even call something like 2001 boring. These are merely two obvious examples, but as far as my taste goes, I generally get bored with common three-act storytelling. Ugh, you and me both. And legitimately enjoy watching and digesting films that would be viewed by most people as difficult or boring. I also love looking at different cultures and ways of life, hence ethnography, and I think cinema is a great way to do that too. I understand that it probably takes a certain kind of film watcher to enjoy, say, Bela Tarr, but I just wonder what the thought process is with regular folks that don't have the stomach for stuff like that. Thanks for the awesome show and great discussions. Robert.
There's a follow-up letter, if you want to go ahead and throw that one on the fire, too.
Is there?
Yes.
I'll get to it.
First of all, Robert, I was kidding when I made the joke about 2 hours of ethnography. Certainly 2 hours of ethnography can be fascinating in the right circumstances and from the right filmmaker. And perhaps, had I not been exhausted, and if I had... when you saw Monica Mondo the first time, you knew what it was.
No.
You hadn't read any of the press releases or whatever?
No.
Then how did you even know to go see it?
Because it was from the people who made Leviathan and Sweetgrass. It was from the producers of Leviathan and Sweetgrass. Okay. And I thought to myself, if they are responsible for Leviathan and Sweetgrass, then I'm going to go see it.
Then in a way you did know what you were expecting, because those movies are also both...
But didn't
like,
you know that it was from those people?
No, I didn't know
are
anything.
Are you sure?
Yes. All right. You were so anal about me not knowing anything about this movie that I wasn't reading.
Because I'm a trickster.
You are. So yeah, no, I am not. I do not have an issue with 2 hours of ethnography. I had an issue with 2 hours of this movie, which just kind of got on my nerves after a while. But no, I think generally speaking, there are lots of great slow films that are terrific. As for why movie people don't want to watch them, I mean, you know,
everyone's an idiot.
There's that theory. certainly our collective attention spans have been under attack for the last 50 years or so. And they're getting shorter all the time, so it's harder for people to surrender to the languor of something like 2001 or Tree of Life. But that is sad, because they should.
Indeed. Yes, they should. We got a letter that is a GIF. From our pal, Nayland Blake. Although there's no text, it is you and me being animated, having a chat over breakfast.
But you have already forbidden me from posting it, so you'll never see it, listeners.
I look goofy. I've got grease splattered all over my t-shirt. I just made waffles and bacon. this is from James Vaughn. The following popped into my head while listening to your latest podcast. This is dated August 17th. Ever thought of doing Linoleum Knife Live podcasts in front of an audience? Take the next step and meet your fans and merchandise the hell out of it. I think that 5 people would show up to that.
We're not averse to the idea. Yeah. I just don't know that we have a strong enough fan base in any one location that we could actually not be embarrassed by our paltry turnout. We have an ever-growing audience, and we appreciate all of you who listen and all of you who have been talking up the show to your friends and talking about it on Twitter. And
If there were enough Los Angeles listeners that would come for a live show, I wouldn't mind doing that. But
totally
I don't know.
The thing is, this is the internet, and you're all over the place. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's hard to get you all in a room.
Besides, Los Angeles is where all of our friends live, and none of our friends listen to this podcast.
No.
Our actual friends do not listen to this show. I take that back. We have some actual friends here in Los Angeles who do listen to the show.
They do.
Because they tell us that they listen to the show.
Yes.
But almost everybody else, including our closest friends, they're like, no, I don't listen to your damn podcast. I've talked to you all the time. So, yeah.
I wanted to mention a couple of people who've been very good about tweeting us and such. At Mr. Greggles, Sean Wicks.
Sean Wicks is always tweeting.
Yes, Ben at PB Ripple.
Him too.
Allison Jones, yes. Tim Bond, of course, Rupert Pupkin.
Yes,
we got retweeted by Stitcher Radio last week on their Twitter feed, which that was very nice. And this is, of course, one of the places where you can hear the show. Bjorn in Dallas,
yes.
Wendy Camo. Thank you guys for tweeting about the show. If you're listening on Twitter,
you should be retweeting us all the time.
Yeah.
Be part of the street team. Make your friends listen.
That's right. We frankly rely on
this is not the only part of this is not the only thing that James Vaughn is saying.
I know, sorry. I went on
James Vaughn, who sends us boxes of British candy.
That's right.
Bless him all the time.
And I had a very nice lunch with him when he was last in Los Angeles. He's a charmer.
The subject line of this email is lots of random short things.
Oh, okay.
Scones and sconce are pronounced fairly similarly in the UK.
Oh, I was asking about that.
There's just a slight change in the emphasis on certain syllables. I don't understand this.
I think he was saying like scones versus skunts.
Any thoughts on where the best physical home movie releases come from? Every territory seems to have a couple of specialist labels, but it makes it like a demented treasure hunt to track down all your favorites that don't get released domestically. I've lost track of the U.S. releases I've bought and have also got hold of French, German, and Australian releases to complete my collection.
I'm not a big...
Keep going.
I'm not a big international DVD buyer, so I don't know. I mean, I would say as far as the United States goes, Criterion Collection, yeah. Shout / Scream Factory, the company called Olive Films that actually has been putting out, they have a lot of the cool sort of deep catalog Paramount stuff that Paramount never got around to putting out, like some of the Otto Preminger films, and Sion Sono's Love Exposure.
Yes.
You know, Cinema Guild and Kino Lorber. Those are good ones.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at your puffy hair.
I washed my hair before I went to bed last night. And I slept on it. Now it's standing up. I know. It's goofy.
Pretty great.
Go on.
Couple of suggestions for films deserving more love and Linoleum Knife dedicated commentary / podcast love, possibly. Okay. The Witches of Eastwick. I don't know why. I don't remember that movie much at all.
Yeah,
about
me neither. Anything.
Poltergeist, Ghost World, oh. The Ritz, Party Girl, Starman, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And well, that'll do for starters. I'm sure you have a list a mile long yourselves, though. Apart from Dave's upcoming book, any forthcoming extracurricular activities coming up we should be looking out for? I'd love to see more commentaries on Blu-rays from you guys, as you are informative and entertaining.
You.
I'm sure we could use the Celluloid Closet, too, if you're brave enough to take that behemoth on.
No, I'm not doing that.
I don't have any extracurriculars coming up other than I'm fixing to record a new story for Unfictional.
Right.
At the beginning of September, and whenever that broadcasts,
I'll
talk about it and link to it.
You have the new book, and you're also...
If I ever finish the dang thing, yes.
But there's also the long-awaited Exile in Guyville audiobook.
That our audio-making friends who have been out of the town for... They've been out of town for like 3 weeks, so they're going to help me.
And I am hoping to do something with 101 Must See Movies for Gay Men.
They're really just going to give me advice on what to do, because we're just going to do it here. These laptops, yeah.
I'm hoping to do something new and different with 101 Must See Movies for Gay Men, since that book turns 10 next year.
Woohoo!
Maybe there's something to be done there. We'll figure it out. So yeah, we're working on it. But in the meantime, you know, go read us at movies.com and the rap and watch What the Flick and stuff.
I'm going to finish this letter here.
Okay.
My road really was on that board game picture you posted.
Oh, I was playing Scotland Yard with some friends. Yeah.
He said, I have literally never heard of that game here, which is even weirder. He was at the very bottom, about two-thirds of the way across. I'm at the corner of Walworth Road and Camberwell Church Street on Camberwell, or is it Camberwell?
You're the one who's lived there. I don't know.
I was there for 6 months, and I don't know how things are pronounced, ever.
Good thing it's not Wales.
And that is all. Thank you for keeping me sane with your podcasts during a few weeks where, after the departure of my assistant, I've been doing two people's work and having to pull several 12-hour days a week to keep my head above water. Your film reviews and domestic chatter are the tonic I need. Long may they reign. All the best. A very, very tired and weary James.
Thank you, James.
Subject line, question, is Boyhood overrated?
Answer, no.
Here's the question. Hey, guys, I had a question in regards to Boyhood. This is from Clay, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
As of now, it has a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes and only 2 negative reviews on the site. I know that both of you really enjoyed it, but I was wondering if you think it's a tad bit overrated. I've seen it twice now, didn't love it the first time, but it certainly improved as I saw it again and noticed things I didn't before. But it didn't hit me like films such as Blue Ruin, the one I love, Enemy, or even Mistaken for Strangers. Again, I liked it and admire it a ton, but I don't think it's a cinematic masterpiece. What are your thoughts? Is it being a bit overblown? This is from Clay Bloodworth, who is a movie critic for the Gulf Breeze News.
I do not see it that way. I think it's a great movie, and people are calling it a great movie, so I cannot find it overrated, because I agree that it is a great movie.
I think it's rated just enough.
Yeah. But, you know, we all have our opinions and our viewpoints, so if for you it is, then it is, you know.
Okay, this is from Matt. Hi, Dave and Alonzo. I don't know how this topic will have changed by the time you record your next episode, but with everything that's happening in Ferguson, Missouri right now...
That's still happening.
Lucky you, nothing's changed.
That's right.
I thought you might want to point your listeners toward a documentary from 2011 called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth.
Spell?
Pruitt-Igoe.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen this documentary. On the surface, it is about a disastrously failed housing project in St. Louis, but it's really about decades of systemic racism in housing, employment, and social policy. There's also an incredible documentary by Frederick Wiseman called Public Housing.
Mm, yes.
That everybody should get a hold of if they can, if you can ever find a copy of it somewhere.
Well, and it's, 5 hours long?
It's 3 or 4 hours long, yeah. Back in the 50s, the city replaced a slum with a then-modern complex of heavily segregated high-rises. Naturally, the projects became a sort of prison for poor black residents. The city allowed the homes to completely deteriorate to the point that it looked like a war zone, while white families fled to suburbs and job opportunities dried up. The place was demolished in the 70s, and it remains a crater to this day. I saw this film a few years ago and have been thinking about it every day while I watch what's happening in Missouri. It's infuriating that the racist, segregated housing of the 1950s is evidently still at work. And this documentary does a better job of explaining how things got the way they are than any other source I've seen. That is from Matt Baum. Where can people see this movie?
The film is called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth, An Urban History.
Hmm.
And according to Can I Stream It, you can buy it on DVD at Amazon, and you can get it on DVD from Netflix, but it's not streaming.
It's not streaming anywhere.
Yeah,
but there's a DVD available on Netflix. If you get DVDs from Netflix,
right? We'll post the link on our page.
Okay.
On our Facebook page.
This is from Jennifer. Hi, Dave and Alonzo. I just sent my money for the Josie and the Pussycats commentary.
Yay!
I'm very excited. I've loved this movie for many years and spent many hours convincing other people that it is wildly underrated. All one should really need to say, in that case, is 4 words. Parker, Posey, Alan, Cumming. I am attaching a photo from the early ooze of me on a very fun one on Halloween night. No, that is not my ghastly apartment in the background. Okay, I'm happy that that is not your ghastly apartment in the background because that is a ghastly apartment in the background of that picture. We are not going to post this picture for anyone else's consumption.
To protect the innocent.
The walls of this apartment are painted the color of the burnt sienna Crayola crayon.
Ew.
Possibly the worst possible thing that you could paint the inside of your house.
Like melted penny?
Like, yeah. It's coppery. It's so oppressive looking. Also, wanted to say that while I made... So you tell your friend, whoever that was, they need to...
Up their interior design game.
Get Murphy Brown's painter dude to come.
Eldon. Wait, what was she dressed as for Halloween?
Josie.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, with the little kitty.
Ears for hats.
Ears, yeah. Also wanted to say that while maybe I need to give it another try, the Schmoes show was the only episode of Linoleum Life that I have turned off halfway through.
People are entitled to their opinions.
No, I know. It's just, I don't care. I've never been one. She goes, I've never been one of your guest hating listeners.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't hate these guys per se.
But
I certainly could have done without all of the talk of hot actresses and the pluses of Megan Fox. Sorry. Hang on. Let me compose myself. And the pluses of Megan Fox wandering around with her mouth open. Ack! Frat humor!
To be fair, Dave is the one who raised the notion of
that is
Megan
true.
Fox's mouth never closing.
I am, the one,
the
one who noticed that Megan Fox never closes her mouth. She does that sort of half-open, sort of like, kind of face all the time. And while that is not, exciting in that way, to me,
the Schmoes were in
clearly it's very exciting to Mark Ellis, half of Schmoes. Did Christian comment on whether or not he liked it in that way?
I don't remember.
Okay. Blame Ellis, because he's a bad person.
Be nice.
Sexist and wrong, that Mark Ellis. Ack, frat humor, stay out of my comfortable linoleum knife bubble. I have faith in you guys, though. If you think I'm misunderstanding it, I'll try listening again. Jennifer from Canada, who was pregnant and didn't get a seat at the clock, and who sent the Partridge Family Christmas cassette.
Oh, yay.
So we dig you, Jennifer.
That's right.
We're sorry. We're sorry for the Schmoes. They'll probably come back someday, though.
And we'll tell them to be better.
No, we're going to let them talk about hot actresses with their mouths open all they want. That's just how it's going to be.
If you want to skip that week, we'll understand.
Obviously, yes, this is, if I were a woman, I would be sort of like, ugh, guys are so gross. Mm. But here's the thing, guys are gross. Guys are so gross. And here's the reason why gay guys don't care about that sort of thing. I mean, they care about women's
issues.
If they're thoughtful gay dudes like us.
We.
When gay guys are objectified by other dudes, they react like a guy would react. They react like, oh, yeah. Like, there's a thing that there's a quality that translates across all the boundaries. And there's a quality of maleness where, because men are so infrequently objectified, and because their objectification has not been used to oppress them, when they are objectified, they don't feel oppressed by it. They don't feel burdened by it. They feel the way a guy wants you to feel. Like, when a guy objectifies you, he's like, what, I'm just complimenting you, because guys are idiots. So when a guy objectifies another guy, the guy being objectified is, I sure do feel complimented right now. What are you looking at me like that for?
We're wading into really weird privilege waters right now.
I know we are. And the thing is, that is male privilege. Mm. Male privilege is that even when you are objectified, you don't feel it.
I guess.
And so when a man is objectified, he doesn't necessarily feel it as an oppressive thing, because it hasn't been used against men in general. Like, nobody has ever objectified me where I was offended by it.
Right.
And the I'm not saying that a woman should feel complimented by a man objectifying them. I'm saying that it's gross. This is the world we live in, and that Mark Ellis is a bad person, and that.
The system is set up that way. It's a bad one.
But it's a bad one, and that's how the system is. Obviously, when the Schmoes come back on, we'll tell them not to
be gross.
Be gross about ladies, and that is. I mean, and honestly, that is also a thing that I do here in my writing and here. I don't like to be the guy who talks about the hot actor.
No, I don't either. It's rare that I do it.
I don't like to be the guy who talks about the hot actor, because I don't want to be.
I know exactly who you mean. You don't have to say it.
I don't want to be the dude who's always at all the screenings that we're at, that I heard after Expendables 3 call Ronda Rousey, Ronda Arouse Me.
Ew.
And he did this out loud in person with other film critics standing around listening. And he was all like, and I was like, you're nasty.
And I assume some of those critics were women.
None that I saw. I didn't see any women around.
Not that that excuses it, but that's gross.
That's the person I don't want to be.
Fair enough. It's good to have role models.
Here's the thing. I give Ellis a pass because he's a stand-up comic.
Yes.
Maybe I shouldn't give Ellis a pass because he's a stand-up comic. I don't know. He is a terrible person, though.
Oh, stop. He's a sweet boy.
But no, I get it. I understand this letter entirely. Yes. And the...
Sorry we let you down. We're still mad at those people who wouldn't give you a seat at the clock when you were pregnant.
I'm super mad at those people still. Addendum to Monica Mana letter.
Yes, see, this is the follow-up.
Hello again, David Alonso. This is in addition to a letter I sent a month ago about Monica Mana and slow cinema. I did happen to see Monica Mana today. And as I had hoped, it was a beautiful film that I'm glad I saw. To Alonzo's complaints about the film, I fail to understand how the lack of immediate information explaining the events of the film hurts the viewing experience. In fact, the mystery about the film enhances the experience. A title card explaining everything to the viewer would take away from the authentic nature of the piece. I don't want to be stepping on any toes here. Go on, man, step! But I think it would be beneficial to give this film another look with a clearer mindset. Yeah, Alonzo! In my opinion, even if you dislike the experience, it's worth a bit more analysis than I got sick of it. In any case, thanks again for the hours and hours of lovely entertainments, Robert. Yeah, Alonzo.
Well, Robert, here's the thing. Before you saw Monica Mana, you heard Dave and me talk about it. So you knew going into the theater what you were going to get. So the lack of a title card and the beautiful mystery of the film is irrelevant because you already knew. You are not the test case. You are a soiled sample. You do not get to be part of this experiment. Now get out. Also, I got sick of it.
He's right, and you're wrong, Alonzo.
I'm sorry. No,
he does not get to say that.
Oh, the mystery. When he did, there was no mystery. He knew what it was going to be because we talked about it. And he read it. He listened to our review.
Robert is our greatest and smartest listener.
Well, he needs to step back.
And you are wrong
from me
about everything. Good day, fellows or fellows. It's the same thing, right?
We are young, fresh fellows.
Number one, Alonzo, not only is Jason Clark not Joel Edgerton, he is also not Matthew Rhys, despite the presence of Kerry Russell. I could not stop thinking he was maybe supposed to be Matthew Rhys. Maybe Malcolm and Ellie were supposed to be Russian spies. The apes definitely should not have let them into the dam.
And Matthew Rhys does wear a lot of wigs on that show, so, you know.
Number two. I was disappointed that your listeners haven't provided more stories of fun movie-going experiences. So this is an older letter.
We just haven't been reading them.
Yeah. No. This came earlier.
Oh,
this,
okay,
this
right.
is from a while back. Since I have already pestered you with one letter, full of unconditional love, but still, I don't want to become a Son of Sam stalker weirdo, the one that stands out in my mind was seeing Ang Lee's The Hulk. Nobody farted, but I'd like to think it was nearly as funny. A group of my friends and I went to a local chain theater that had $5 Tuesdays, which meant that families of four or more usually picked that day to bring their kids and participate in all those movie-going behaviors so repugnant to Dave. Normally, those behaviors, most notably talking, are also repugnant to me. But the chaos really livened up the Hulk.
I believe the Ang Lee version is just called Hulk.
It might be. I love and own many of Ang Lee's movies, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Brokeback Mountain, Sense and Sensibility, The Ice Storm. Boy, do I love The Ice Storm. I'm digressing from the letter now.
Oh, and hitting the
microphone. I'm a big fan of The Ice Storm.
I like parts of Ride with the Devil quite a bit. Mm. People don't ever talk about that one.
He says, but from what I remember, Hulk was Dullsville. We were seated next to a standard four plus member $5 Tuesday family, that's what he's trying to say, who was led by either a dad or grandpa who had no patience for questions or requests for treats. So rather than pay attention to the ponderous pacing of the movie or Nick Nolte's hobo styles, we all decided to listen to this gentleman rap out answers to sotto voce questions in normal conversational volume. No, we already made one trip. Here, have some popcorn. B, then go to the bathroom. C, I don't know, why don't you watch? And our personal favorite that we repeated for months and months afterwards, I don't tell Tiffany nothing. Me neither.
No, never.
Tiffany.
She knows.
She can drop dead. I don't tell her nothing. Your recent reviews of Begin Again and Endless Love and your discussion around movies that blatantly pander for emotional reactions, particularly tears, reminded me of how much I hated Patch Adams.
Ooh.
I hadn't thought of that stupid a-hole movie in years, so thanks for that. This must have been before the death of Robin Williams,
yes.
When we all decided that Patch Adams was suddenly great.
Exactly.
Again, much love from Chicago, Jesse.
Thank you, Jesse.
Yes, I am catching up on episodes I missed or failed to finish. My husband and I were both 9 when Star Wars came out in 1977, making us the perfect age to be influenced by it. When they re-released it in 1997, we had to go see it. Opening night of the theater, we're looking around and felt like everybody in that theater was within 5 years of age of us. We'd all seen it the first time as kids. As the movie goes on, I'm discovering that I'm not getting immersed in nostalgia. I'm seeing it through adult eyes for the first time. When we get to the point that Luke is complaining that he wanted to go to the academy, somebody hollered from the back, "Man, what a whiner!" The audience erupted with laughter. For me, at least, it was a relief. It wasn't just me having this reaction to a film I'd held up all those years as brilliant. Xanadu also failed to hold up between when I saw it in the theater and when I saw it a couple years ago. Thankfully, the music is still great. Okay, I saw Xanadu in the theater, and I was in high school, and boy, that movie sucks.
I somehow didn't see it.
It sucked then.
In the theater.
It sucks now.
I'll watch it whenever.
I know, no, you will.
I mean, I saw Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in the theater.
Me
and
too.
I didn't see Xanadu. I don't know why. But yeah, I kind of love-hate that movie. Like, I know what's wrong with it, but it's still, you know, I get a kick out of it.
Mr.'s Durrell.
Wait, who wrote that letter?
Wendy.
Ah.
Sorry. Mr.'s Durrell Dan White.
Monsieur.
I, for one, appreciated last week's show's preoccupation with mortality and impending death. This was not last week's right. Show, it was a few weeks back. Although the topic in question has very little to do with me, as I am going to be young and beautiful forever, and will never have to worry about such petty concerns. But that doesn't mean I don't appreciate other people grappling with the great abyss. Anyway, on to the point. I sent my top 10 list in about a year ago and got 100%. Not a big deal, I'm just a regular guy with perfect cinematic taste. So I figured I'd send in another list, but this time I'd feature my top 10 favorite films that I have discovered through this very podcast.
Wow.
Through reviews, DVD picks, random tangents, etc. Consider it a sort of tip of the hat for all of the great films you two have championed over the years.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. L'Atalante.
Oh, Jean Vigo.
Jean Vigo, 1934. Absolutely beautiful. Vigo's premature death is one of those great what-ifs in cinematic history. Fun side note. I once did a search for Jean Vigo on Hulu to see what they had available, and the search engine came back to ask me if perhaps I hadn't been searching for mom jeans.
There's a really lovely biopic about Jean Vigo directed by Julian Temple.
Yes.
Which I saw years ago at Toronto, but was never released in the U.S. But it stars James Frayne, and people should seek it out if they can find it.
The Touring Horse.
No.
I sent in an email once about how I was hungover on New Year's Day and decided to spend the day in a dark room watching The Touring Horse. Don't know if it was the best decision of my life or the worst, but Tar is now one of my absolute favorites. 3. Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives. Apishat Pong, where is Seth Akul, 2010. Touring Horse, Bela Tarr, 2011. He describes this as beautiful, serene, weird. 4. Fists in the Pocket.
Oh,
yeah. Marco Bellocchio, 1965. I knew that post-war Italian cinema could be beautiful, and I knew that it could be sad, but I never knew that it could be so bleepin' angry. I like it when it's angry. Me too. It's my favorite thing. The Raid, Redemption. Evans, 2010. Y'all already know. Number 6, Love Exposure. Sean Sono, 2008. Like Barry Lyndon, if Barry Lyndon were about porn and Christ and dressing up as a lesbian superhero. 7, A Touch of Sin. Maybe the best film I've seen about the economic state of the world we live in right now. We could use a few American filmmakers looking at our own state of affairs with the same mix of rage and discipline as Zhia does here. Zhia Zhengke, 2013. Shoah, Claude Lanzmann, 1985. I picked up the Blu-ray during one of those 50% off Criterion sales. Forced myself to watch the whole thing in one sitting.
Whoa!
For those of you who don't know, Shoah is over 9 hours long.
Theatrically, it was shown in two parts, and even those two parts had an intermission between them.
Yeah.
Or each part had its own intermission.
It was overwhelming, but a film like this is supposed to be overwhelming. I know Alonso has some issues with the translation lag time in some of the talking head interviews, but this extra bit of time is often exploited cinematically. I completely agree with you here. Allowing the camera to slowly push along a set of abandoned railroad tracks, invoking a sort of stillness and dread that is absolutely heartbreaking in context to the stories being told. Yes, you're absolutely right. Number 9, O Hussard Baltasar! Bresson, 1966. Can't look at a donkey without wanting to cry now. 10, Weekend. Haig, 2010. Quiet, smart, heartbreaking. So really, he says, thanks guys, Evan is who wrote the letter. Really, Evan, you're thanking me, because most of these films are ones that I have recommended on this show. I am the god.
You are the goat.
Dear freeling Ricky Candyface Mistooks, Sex Happening, and Alonzo. You asked for unusual theater experiences.
Did you say who wrote the previous letter?
Evan.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Because I am a misanthropic bastard who despises people, I generally watch films at distinctly off-peak times. I'm with you on that.
Monday at 10 a.m.?
Monday morning, 10 o'clock, dude. I'm telling you. I saw Tom McCarthy's Win-Win and Kim Ki-duk's Pieta in completely different screens. However, watching as many films as I do for my own podcast, that is known as Raw Footage, and it is at raw-footage.co.uk.
Co, yes.
Yeah. As I previously told you, I watched 157 films at the cinema in 2013. It gets expensive. And wherever possible, I get tickets to free preview screenings. Sorry, dude. Sometimes this gets good results, watching the first Raid in a packed preview screening. Now that would have been maybe all right.
Yeah.
With audible, oh my god, did I just see that, gasps at every action beat was special. Perhaps the strangest experience was attending a preview of Magic Mike. I already know where this is going. I was one of maybe 3 guys watching the film solo in an overwhelmingly female audience. It's also likely I was one of the few straight guys in the audience, as the majority of accompanied men were accompanied by other men. I was interested in the film as possibly one of the last cinematic outings of Steven Soderbergh. The rest of the crowd wanted to see Channing Tatum and or Matthew McConaughey naked. Channing Tatum.
You just said Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum?
Yes.
Well, that's his real name.
Uh-huh.
Channing Tatum is a screen name that he chose.
I see.
Because Channing Tatum sounds ridiculous.
Yes, it certainly does.
When Tatum does his routine in the middle of the film, I watched in a detached, that guy can really dance way. Oh, come on. You know you were. You got a little bit of heat from Channing Tatum. The rest of the crowd wanted to see him naked. I was sitting there awash with estrogen, also testosterone, dude.
Yeah.
Some of those guys in the theater, they were giving off the other kind of vibration.
See objectification, comma, male. Yeah.
Perhaps you would like to revisit our conversation from 10 minutes ago about objectification. And how some people don't understand it very well, even as they are doing it and or experiencing it.
Or explaining it.
Or explaining it. I explained it. I think I did a reasonable job explaining the unfortunate state of the world that we live in and how it sucks to be a woman scrutinized by the male gaze all the time.
Fair enough.
Listen to you.
Just read the letter.
I may have taken a circuitous route. It got the job done.
Fine.
Yeah. After a while, I stopped experiencing the film and started experiencing the crowd. It was frenzied. Whenever an inch of naked male flesh was on screen, the crowd went wild. My thing is frozen here. Hang on. And while it was kind of cool, it was also disappointing that the things that I really took out of the film, Tatum's financial struggles and Pettifer's coming of age, were largely ignored by the rest of the crowd. I totally understand what this is about. I came out of the screen having enjoyed the film, but having enjoyed the experience more. I also wanted to say thanks for your recommendation of Concussion, Alonzo. After your review, I made a special effort to make one of the very few screenings that were on at my local art house cinema, and it's currently one of my favorite films of the year, and definitely my favorite leading female role of the year.
Cool.
That is Colin. He is from Bath.
Thank you, Colin, from Bath.
In England.
Dave hasn't seen Concussion yet.
I have not seen Concussion yet. Yes, it's funny. Even though I am one homosexual who, let's just say I look at Joe Manganiello the way that Mark Ellis looks at Megan Fox. Manganiello or Manganiello?
Manganiello, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, Magic Mike
is... I, too, watched that film and saw it as a film about the economy and about hopelessness and about being in a dead-end situation.
Yeah.
The dancing was fine. Like, I don't... In spite of the fact that I do look at Manganiello the way that Ellis looks at Megan Fox, I didn't look at him that way while I was watching the film. I have to be sort of... I have to look at him as a person to lust after him in the way that... Like, I don't get all bunged up and turned on by actors as characters in films. They don't inspire me sexually.
Paul Giamatti as Santa Claus. I'm just saying.
Okay. Paul Giamatti as Santa Claus. You're my other Megan Fox. You pulled that right out of thin air. Okay, so anyway. If I'm into an actor, if I think an actor is real hot, it's always usually like, are they on the cover of GQ modeling clothes? Like, that's when I indulge.
Not portraying.
I mean, because honestly, let's go back and talk about Ellis and Megan Fox a little bit more. I think that the history of cinema is honestly about, in one way, not fully, not, it's just one aspect of the history of cinema, but the history of cinema is at least partially about the people on screen sort of stepping into the role of your fantasy lover or whatever.
Godard says the history of cinema is boys taking pictures of girls.
People taking pictures of people.
Well, quoting him.
Quoting him, that's his quote. But in general, this is what we're talking about. And so, I get, it's gross.
But
Magic
Mike is in a weird...
Very real.
Is in a weird place.
People react to this stuff that way.
It's a film that was sold, and I think probably...
Well, it was marketed as a prurient experience.
It was marketed, and I think probably that's what helped get it made. I mean, I think if Soderbergh had said, I want to make this movie about the bleak economy with Channing Tatum, nobody would have cared.
Right.
But like, I want to make a low-budget movie where Channing Tatum, you know, takes off his kit and talks about the economy, then yes, they're in, you know.
Yeah, no, I know, I understand that. And again, we go back to the thing of that's the way the world works.
Yeah.
You know,
the steak, the economy is the steak in this scenario, but the nudity is the sizzle.
Yeah.
And they sold the sizzle. And I think a lot of...
Megan Fox is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles female lead and not Elizabeth Moss.
Right.
Because she's Megan Fox.
Right.
Now, it also happens that Megan Fox can act and actually delivers a performance in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, I think she's getting a bad rap for that movie. I mean, it's...
The fact that she doesn't close her mouth was just a weird
thing. That's an issue between her and her plastic surgeon, probably.
Well, no, she's too young to have had plastic surgery. But, like, the... That's just a thing that I kept noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And... But, yeah, I mean, there's a very real economic reason why she's the female lead.
Right.
She's cartoon hot. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, in that...
Little Annie Fanny
kind of
way.
You meet someone in person who looks like that, and you're kind of frightened of them because you think, you're supernaturally good-looking. Like,
The movie itself is exploitative of her. Like, there's a lot of her bending over to do things.
Oh, yes.
There's, I mean, that...
It absolutely is.
When Michelangelo tells
her
that...
There's a shot of her butt going up a ladder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When Michelangelo tells her that she makes his shell tight, it's like, no.
Right.
Stop that.
Stop doing that in a children's movie.
Yeah, especially,
But just stop doing it in general. Yeah. Next letter. Okay, these are all the letters from the letter file. Here is another top 10 list. Greetings and salutations, Alonzo and Dave. My 2-year-old daughter Lydia and I are huge fans. Thanks, Lydia. We would like Lydia to watch Oogie Loves.
Only if she follows all the instructions on screen, though.
She enjoys dancing to the opening themes of Linoleum Knife and B-Movies podcast while screaming, podcast, podcast. Sharknado 2, the second one, is coming soon. So this was from about a month ago.
Mm.
But knowing how long it takes you guys to get to your letters, it has probably been out for a while now. Let's talk bad movies. What are your favorite bad movies? I love bad movies, and I will take this time to share my faves with you. Do you have a favorite all-time bad movie?
Gosh. I mean, you know, maybe The Apple? Maybe Valley of the Dolls?
Mind Change.
Yeah, it fluctuates. I mean, I had an after last season period, but that's hard to watch sometimes.
After last season is so weird.
I'm taking a break from The Room. Like, I've still never watched the entire riff tracks of it.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sure I'll come back to it at some point.
Yeah.
Like, after I get around to finally reading the Greg Sestero book, I'm sure I'll want to see it again.
The one I feel like I recommend a lot to people is Why Did I Get Married 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I've talked about it so many times.
Oh, and Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor.
Yeah. But Temptation is a drama. And so is Why Did They Get Married 2? But Why Did They Get Married 2 has, like, that sort of extra bump of full-blown insanity that comes along in the last act. I mean, it sets it a cut above
Temptation.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So here are hers. Tyler Perry's Temptation. This movie glued me to the screen, had me glued to the screen for all the wrong reasons. From the opening scene of the marriage counselor telling the cautionary tale of her sister's wandering eye, who is so clearly her from the beginning, to Brandy showing up with full-blown AIDS and the mother's attempts at exorcising the devil from her daughter. Remember that part?
Yes.
I was loving every minute of it. The Lucky One. This movie took me by complete surprise. Zac Efron had the personality of wet cardboard, and the whole thing was pretty boring. Then the funniest thing in cinema happens. When Piper from Orange is the New Black's ex-husband is crushed to death by his son's treehouse in front of his son, I nearly died myself. I was LOLing on the floor of my living room and replaying that part over and over again.
If you like bad Zac Efron movies,
I was chuckling very, very quietly.
I have not seen this one
in the press screening. Yeah.
If you like bad Zac Efron movies, you might want to check out Charlie St. Cloud, in which he plays the most haunted person with the best hair in the history of cinema.
Showgirls, and all she writes is duh. I have a different opinion of showgirls.
I see both sides.
Yeah. Starving in Suburbia. I don't know what this
is. Don't know that one.
It says, the title says it all. I was channel surfing when I found this gem on Where Else? Lifetime. I thought to myself, ooh, anorexia movie. I won't spoil it because you should see it, but this movie is just awesome. All caps, awesome! Exclamation point. Hashtag thinspiration.
It's going in Tebow.
The alternate. I don't know what this is either.
I don't know that one either.
Eric Roberts must save the president who has been kidnapped by his chief of staff. Oh, she wrote chef, and I thought, kidnapped by his chef? I totally gotta watch that. Chief of staff in a stupid attempt to win the re-election. The movie also stars Ice-T.
Oh, well.
And is a terrible wannabe diehard. It manages to be both horrible and amazing. Footloose, the remake.
We both
really liked the Footloose
remake.
Hey,
now.
I held off seeing this for a very long time. I was thinking I wouldn't really make a difference. It wouldn't really make a difference in my life if I saw it or not. OMG, was I wrong. My life is now better for having watched the Footloose remake. Why? Why would they show the teenagers dying in the beginning? That was kind of weird.
To the song Footloose.
To the song Footloose. Why would they have the teenagers die in a horrific car crash while Footloose is playing? That's true.
It's a strange choice.
Tell me, I'm not the only one who nearly busted my gut laughing at that part. Please tell me, because I feel kind of bad about it. No, you're right.
It was a ridiculous idea.
When I am in a bad mood, I put the first one. It's this movie on. It's seriously what I turn to put a smile on my face. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy the movie as a whole. I may come for the death in the beginning, but I stay for the dancing. It's just the opening is so funny. What is it? Is it the fact that the kids die a horrible death while the song Footloose is playing? Yes. That is
exactly it.
That's exactly it. Is it the fact that they're all talking like annoying teenagers before they die? They're all acting like annoying teenagers before they die by talking loudly over each other, blasting the music, talking on their cell phones, and taking their eyes off the effing road so they can kiss their girlfriend, resulting in everyone's death. Why do I love watching the kids in the beginning of this movie die so much? One of life's mysterious pleasures, I guess. I can't help but love these not-so-good movies. What bad movies do you guys die laughing over? Well, now, the beginning of the new Footloose.
Yes, we're seeing it in a whole new light.
Keep being awesome, you guys, and keep talking about mundane married people stuff like spaghetti pie, tea, and shopping. Best wishes, Corey and Lydia.
Thank you, Corey, and thank you, Lydia.
Hey, Dave and Lonzo, really enjoy the show. It's become a great pick-me-up to help get me through my Monday mornings. I was watching I Am Divine, the documentary by Jeffrey Schwartz.
Yes.
Last weekend with my girlfriend, who's a big John Waters and Divine fan, and she was quite thrown off when I piped up, oh, hey, Alonzo. She doesn't listen to the podcast and was thus unaware of my strong affection for you both.
Oh.
A short explanation of your show and its importance in the pop culture landscape ensued, to the accompaniment of the appropriate rolling of eyes. Hey, no. But since I'm writing this anyway, I was hoping that we could get an update on the new mattress. If you haven't already done so by the time you read this, did we update people on the mattress?
I don't know if we've discussed it.
We got the new mattress.
We got the new mattress, and it came... It came the day after Outfest was over, when I was just bone exhausted.
Yeah.
The timing couldn't have been better.
Let me tell you.
It makes all the difference.
The firmest of the firm, this mattress. Which I learned is a thing that a lot of people don't want.
Yeah.
In a mattress. They want softy soft. They want to sink in. They want
a cloud.
They want to sleep on a pillow. I do not want to sleep on a pillow. I want to sleep on top of a Donald Judd concrete cube.
With a fitted sheet on it.
Yeah, that is what I want for my bed. I want to go to LACMA to those 5 Donald Judd cubes that separate it from the La Brea tar pits, and I want to sleep on top of one at night. That is how firm I want my mattress to be.
This one
is that firm.
We had been sleeping on a janky mattress for so long that
we'd forgotten what sleep was like.
The first night that we slept on the mattress, we actually woke up a little sore the next morning because our spine was being put back in the correct position. It's been great.
Also, as a fan of the same kinds of noisy music as Dave, I think it would be great if he talked about what he was listening to right now or made music recommendations on a regular basis. This guy is full of ideas.
Oh, brother.
Full of great ideas.
Don't encourage him. What you listen to right now, Dave?
Well, in the cassette player, as I do the dishes, is a release by the local Los Angeles metal band Harasser, led by Pete, a guy we know.
Oh, that's his band. Okay.
Harasser have just put out a new album on a bigger label. So they're like moving up in the world now.
Did they sign with Merge?
Dude, they're totally gonna sign with Merge. Them and FKA Twigs, like they're totally signing with Merge. But here's the thing: I have to confess to everything, though, right? I mean, I'm not just listening to the Harasser cassette. The cassette I'm listening to is called Hater of Man. By the way, it's also not brand new. It's a few years old.
You're also listening to the new Kylie Minogue in the car.
Listening to the new Kylie Minogue in the car, which is called "Kiss Me Once."
Featuring the hit Sexercise.
I have to look. Someone had to address the issue of Sexercise. And who else?
But Kylie.
But Kylie should address that issue. How many other people are talking about the importance of Sexercise in the culture? You don't see it. The lamestream media isn't. And you know that Sexercise is very important to a lot of people.
Bounce, bounce, bounce.
It just doesn't get the attention or the analysis
it deserves.
That it deserves. Kylie Minogue is a cultural theorist.
She will be silent no longer.
On the subject of Sexercise. So you just calm down.
What else does this letter say?
No, I'm fixing to confess something.
Oh.
In addition to that, I'm also listening to the first Fleetwood Mac album that had Stevie Nicks on it. Because I have tickets to see Fleetwood Mac at the Forum the night after Thanksgiving. Which I'm stoked for. Because Fleetwood Mac were the best. I have come across a thing that is embarrassing. And it shouldn't be embarrassing to me. Because I grew up as a child, I was obsessed with the Partridge Family, as many people know. There was a British family singing group in the 70s that never made one inch of noise in the United States. Like, Americans do not know who these people are. But I just found out about them. And they are the definition of dorky. Like, if you look up dorky in a UK dictionary.
Dorky with a U.
It has a picture of the singing Nolan sisters next to it. The Nolans were a six-sister Irish pop group. They sang and did choreography.
Played me none of this?
The Brady Bunch did on later episodes of the Brady
like
Bunch.
Silver Platters era?
Yeah. And they became well known and had I Wikipedia'd them after I saw this one video of them dancing on the Cliff Richard show. I'm gonna show it to you after.
I was gonna say I feel deprived now.
The songs are embarrassingly silly, but these girls could sing harmonies with each other, and it was like it's like the Cowsills and the Partridge Family, and
they were the lead up to the Reynolds girls.
They had like a disco hit later in the late 80s. Obviously, you know, because they got famous and because their lives became public information, there's some sadness and darkness in this story that I'm not even going to bring up right now because it would cloud your understanding.
Okay.
When I show you this clip of them dancing and singing their very first time appearing on television on the Cliff Richard show, it's Cliff.
We'll put it on the Facebook page, too.
I don't even know how I stumbled across them. I think it was because I was looking at a Partridge Family performance clip or a Cowsills thing on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And then it said the Nolans. And I was like, I don't even know who that is. And I looked at it and
had to know everything.
And then after that one song, I was like, who are these girls?
Do they have a Christmas album? That's what I wonder.
I don't know. Mm. I don't know. I'll show you the thing after. Anyway, so that's what's going on right now.
If anyone cares what I've been listening to.
They don't.
I'm going to say it anyway.
They don't care. No one cares.
I highly recommend the cast album to Fun Home, the musical based on the wonderful graphic memoir by Alison Bechdel, which has been an off-Broadway show and is going to be eventually opening on Broadway, but it's done by Janine, the woman who did Carolina Jane. I'm forgetting. Janine Tesoro, I believe, is her name. I'm not a giant show tune person, but I'm really enjoying this cast album. So
the letter continues. Unfortunately, I don't have any great in theater experiences to share with you, as I am from Canada.
Everyone comes correct.
Well, clearly you have not been pregnant trying to get a seat at the clock, have you?
Good point.
Yeah. And Canadians, on the whole, are quite boring while out in public. Anyway, thanks for the show. Keep up the good work. Here's my top 10 list. Number 1, Repo Man.
Yay.
Number 2, you know what? We didn't knife the other lists.
Oh, well, movies that we recommended.
They were all 100%.
Of course, 100%.
Honestly, yes. Really. Yeah. Number 1, Repo Man.
Uh-huh.
Number 2, The Big Lebowski.
Still never seen it.
Number 3, A Christmas Story.
Yay.
Number 4, RoboCop.
Yay.
Number 5, Casino.
Assuming he means the original RoboCop.
1987 yes. RoboCop, okay. Yes. Number 5, Casino. I'm a big fan of Casino.
Okay.
Well, you're going to chop off?
I'm not going to chop off, but right. It's no Goodfellas.
Dark City.
Okay.
I thought it was fine, yeah. The Prestige.
Yeah.
It's good, yeah. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Never seen it.
Hardcore Logo. I don't know what that is.
That is a Canadian film, an influential Canadian film that I've been meaning to see for a long time. It's Bruce
McGillicuddy?
Yes, it's Bruce McGillicuddy. Hardcore Logo, yeah, it is a well-known, it's sort of like the Canadian Spinal Tap.
Oh, right.
And I've always heard that it's great, and I'm sure if he's still listening to the program, Malcolm Ingram is shaking his head at me for not having watched it. But, that is a very good movie.
Well, we're going to give it to you.
Totally, yes.
100% knife, Amos. That's the letter writer. Thank you, Amos, for that letter. All right.
And for being named Amos.
We're in the home stretch of letters. If you're tired, take a break. We got a few more to go. And then we're going to, that's all the letters. We're going to head into the new school year.
Fresh.
All right, here we go.
Bruce McDonald. I knew it was something like that.
Dear Alonzo and Man with Too Many Nicknames, formerly known as Dave White, the most epically terrible experience I have ever had was when I went to see Pulp Fiction for the first time. You see, I was 13 when Pulp Fiction came out, and my movie watching was still being cautiously monitored for R-rated films. My parents allowed me to go see the latest Arnold movie, but was even leery about my watching Serial Mom. When Pulp Fiction came out, it was getting rave reviews, and I was demanding to see it.
But Mom, it won the Palme d'Or.
Exactly. The local newspaper said it was rated R for language, graphic violence, and drug use, but I didn't go into details.
It didn't go into details. I think is what he meant to say.
Oh, but didn't go into details. Sorry. With that description in hand, I convinced my parents to take me to it, and we decided to make a family affair with my action movie loving uncle and my demure aunt going on a family trip to see Pulp Fiction. These stories never end well.
No.
The seating arrangement went me, my dad, my uncle, my aunt, and my mom. The lights go down, the film starts up, and the barrage of F-bombs hit our ears. Not to mention, the F-bombs were in service to a nihilistic discussion of robbing restaurants. By the end of the first scene, when Pumpkin and Honey Bunny hit the table, my mother was glaring at me from 5 seats over. Just continually getting more and more uncomfortable. Okay, fine. Maybe it was just the opening scene, we all think. The second scene starts up, the characters change, and the barrage of F-bombs continues, only now with frank discussions of burgers and sex. Once we're done with that, we get to the violence, as they casually shoot the kids in the apartment. My mother was fit to be tied by the end of this sequence. The apartment scene ends, and then comes the swanky sounds of Al Green, and the title card of Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's wife comes on. We had to leave the theater. By the time we hit the hallway, my uncle was hooting and laughing because my mother was glaring across the aisles so hard, and she was giving me an earful. So we decide to hit the PG-13 Forrest Gump instead.
Oh, 1994.
As it was in the theater next door. Fine, I had seen it over the summer, but whatever. We walk in really late, but it doesn't matter because the movie theater was mostly empty anyways. It was October at this point. What's the second scene that happens? Jenny singing naked in college. Yeah, we went from F-bombs and violence to a naked woman playing a guitar. I didn't live that down for ages. But the best postscript happened when a few months later, my paternal grandmother said that she thought Pulp Fiction was one of the best movies of the year. My father almost fell down in shock at that statement. To this day, my parents do not like that movie, but I fell in deep love with it. That's from Chris, a.k.a. Julius Kassendorf of thesolute.com. THE-SOLUTE.com.
I think part of growing up is discovering that you love movies that your parents hate and vice versa.
Yes.
Say two.
Subject line. Dave White may be too freewheeling.
I somehow doubt it, but go on.
Dare I say this, but would you believe that as I was listening to Dave read the original email on the podcast and hearing you guys playfully mock my running and golfing habits, I was on an elliptical machine at the gym. Cue more mocking. Bob. Exercise. That's all you're going to get. I guess a lot of people listen to us while they exercise.
I guess. The thing people do.
Here's from Sean Wicks.
Ah.
Great tweeter of us.
Yes.
Hello, Dave and Alonzo. After hearing some listeners provide their comical movie-going experiences, I was reminded recently of my most uncomfortable movie-going moment when I stumbled upon Cactus Flower playing on TV. Anytime I see or hear the name of Goldie Hawn, I am reminded vividly of this moment, almost like when I visited a Hooters during one of my first Comic-Cons, and the waitress took an inopportune time while I was biting down on a sandwich to tell my table an explicit joke involving feces. Well, like, she would get an amazing tip from me. Any waiter or waitress that tells me a joke about feces while I'm eating, 30% tip.
You're the worst.
That person is doing their job amazingly well.
Hashtag thinspiration.
While I couldn't tell you the joke now, if I were to step inside a Hooters, I would be able to recite it word for word, which has kept me away from that restaurant ever since. Not really a loss. Well, you like their wings,
though. I do like their wings. Yes.
You also like how the old Hooters used to be directly underneath the offices of the Advocate magazine. Yeah.
The Advocate's not there anymore. The Hooters is. The
Advocate is no longer there, but the Hooters still is. And y'all, all of y'all gay and lesbians would go down from the Advocate office to the Hooters for lunch.
Yeah, on Tuesdays, because it was double punch day
yeah.
on the card. And it was hilarious, because we felt like we were the only ones who were not objectifying the waitresses. Like, they would actually tell us about, you know, their master's degree they were pursuing, or, you know, their audition they had the next day, or whatever.
Excuse me, but my breasts are down here.
Do you mind, gentlemen?
Anyhow, the incident occurred in August of 1991 when I went to see the John Candy comedy Delirious in a theater in downtown Kitchener, Ontario.
Whoa.
I remember it vividly as I had just fought through a bad case of food poisoning the day before and was still slightly queasy, and it was one of those muggy, humid Canadian summer days where most people in the theater didn't care what movie they were seeing. They only cared that the air conditioner was on.
It's Delirious.
As we sat waiting, a pair of dudes walked into the theater, a couple you could not miss noticing. One was verging on obese with a bad comb-over and wearing super tight beige shorts. Now, as a fat man myself, I will tell you that super tight beige shorts are not what you need in your life.
No.
My fellow fats, don't do that. Don't do it to yourself.
Breezy.
Be sexy and fat all day long. Just know what to wear.
And shave your head. Then this comb-over crap.
Know what clothes to put on, yeah. They were tight in a way that once seen, that image cannot be unseen and will stick with me until my dying day. The other was a much thinner gentleman with crazy hair, clothes that did not fit his frame at all, glasses that were way too big for his face, and even though he wasn't physically wearing a pocket protector, he was in spirit. This being Canada, the crowd was polite and didn't say anything, but you could tell that all eyes were fixed on these two as they sat near the front and chomped on their popcorn loudly as well as spoke in high voices. The lights went down for the trailers, and much to the relief of the people around me and me, the two characters at the front quieted right down. That is, until a trailer for the Goldie Hawn thriller Deceived played. If you remember the film, I do.
I do.
It starred Goldie as a housewife in jeopardy who, after her husband dies, learns that he may have been leading a double life and that her whole marriage was a sham. It was.
She was deceived.
The trailer ends with Goldie crying out desperately for help, and in the silence, as that trailer ended, and the next one was about to start, the larger dude yells out at the top of his lungs in a whiny, affected voice, "We'll help you, Goldie!" He held on to the L, the D, and the IE for a while. There were uncomfortable gasps and slight nervous laughter from the audience. Many not sure how to take this guy, and I'm sure there were thoughts of, do we have a serial killer sitting amongst us? Remember, this was 1991, and only months after Silence of the Lambs had been released, and at the time as well, a murderous couple was going around southern Ontario killing teenage girls and leaving their body parts in cement.
Ew. That's not very Canadian.
That doesn't sound, okay. Anyway, later in life, I was walking on the red carpet for the Eyes Wide Shut premiere in Westwood and decided and ended up behind Kurt Russell and Goldie. I so wanted to yell out in that voice, "I'll help you, Goldie!" But thought better of it because, well, Snake Plissken, not to mention the army of security guards standing nearby. I still think it would have brought closure to that part of my life. But oh well. Love the show, Sean.
Maybe sharing the story with us will provide a catharsis.
Yes. Thank you for the review of God's Not Dead. Yeah. This is from Brianna.
Mm-hmm.
Upon receiving the God's Not Dead text message from an acquaintance who, by the way, wasn't even in my contacts.
Yeah.
What she's talking about is, at the end of God's Not Dead, the characters all begin texting each other the message, "God's Not Dead."
Is it and they, hashtag God's Not Dead?
And they send it to everyone in their contact list. Mm-hmm. And they are encouraged to do this by the Christian rock band Newsboys.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you, and they tell the movie audience as well.
Yeah.
Like there's a message on the end of the end of the movie. Text "God's Not Dead" to everyone you know. Like that's literally in the film, instructing the audience to text this to everybody. I immediately asked a mutual friend why on earth this girl would send such a weird text message to me. When she explained that it was from the movie, I was horrified. I was even more horrified to read the reviews of the movie. I am a Christian, and I haven't gotten up the nerve to go see it. I think it's good to know what's out there, but I hate the thought of giving any money to the producers of this film. Anyways, I'm very glad to have read your review. I wanted to let you know that there's a new Christian movie coming out that I'm hoping changes how Christian films are made. I know which one she's about to tell me. I've seen the trailer. It's well made, with a good cast, and it's funny for Christians and non-Christians alike. There's no bashing of other religions. If anything, it takes a look at some of the things Christians might have wanted to reconsider. But most of all, But most of all, I like that at the end it leaves the audience with a conversation rather than bashing them over the head with a specific message. The movie is called Believe Me. I don't know anything about this film other than that I've seen the trailer. Nick Offerman is in it.
And Zachary Knight from Happy Endings is in it. Yeah.
I'll be seeing it.
Sure.
Because guess what? We forgot to talk about When the Game Stands Tall.
No!
Well, I'm going to tell you all about When the Game Stands Tall right now.
Go.
Christian football movie. Not the worst thing you've ever seen in your life. It's not an especially exciting football movie. but it is kind of a thoughtful Christian movie. Like, if you are in the, you know, if you are within the conservative evangelical or conservative Catholic Christian worldview, you will probably really like this movie. And if you are not a Christian, but aren't hostile to Christianity, you will probably also think this movie is just fine. It's not an exciting football movie, and it cannot be an exciting football movie because it places its moral message above
the sports.
So that final act trouncing that you always get in a sports movie, the one where the underdog team comes from behind, it doesn't exist here because the team is not an underdog team. They're a team that has recently lost their footing because they broke a 151-game winning streak, which is a true story. It's about a high school in Northern California, a Catholic boys' school, coached by a legendary coach named Bob Lutterser. I don't know how you say his name. Anyway.
Who's played by Jim Caviezel.
Jim Caviezel. The film goes really low-key. And Jim Caviezel's performance is also really low-key, to the point of being chilly, which is also does not serve the movie well. It is an okay film. But its take on Christianity is fine because it's not hateful and it's not gross and it doesn't rejoice in the suffering of anyone, much less their, you know, quote-unquote enemies. So there's nothing to hate about this movie at all. And unlike Heaven is for Real, which is equally sort of gentle-minded, this film doesn't expect you to believe the first-person testimony of a four-year-old who claims he's been to heaven.
So it's got that going for it.
So yes, it does in fact have that going for it. It's based on real events that everyone could have seen with their own eyes. Yeah, not a great movie, but not a rotten movie, and not a bad Christian movie, because this whole wave of Christian movies the past year or so, most of them are just straight-up garbage.
Mom's Night Out.
Yeah. But I tell you, even when the movie is sort of mediocre, if they get the Christianity right in a way that isn't disgusting and repellent, I kind of got to throw my hat to it a little bit. Like, all right, more of this, please. And less of this other nonsense.
I'm just biding my time until we get the Left Behind reboot with Nicolas Cage and Chad Michael Murray.
Speaking of Christmas, that is going to be some Christmas. All right, this is from Phil. Dear Linoleum Knife, in reference to the recent few podcasts, thank you for the schooling on Mac and Me. But I must whisper in your ears that I wince every time either of you make the same mistake of speaking in comparatives. Hearing a line from this latest podcast, I also believe the correct saying is could not care less, not could care less. Did one of us say could care less?
Maybe.
Instead of could not care less?
Because that would be wrong, but we might have done it.
One of us might have slipped up and said could care less. Yes. I'm sure it was you.
Probably you.
No, I'm sure it was you.
You're the
Because I
you're
never
the,
mistake.
You're the sloppy one.
I never mistake that one. I always get could not care less.
Uh-huh. Really, Channum Tating?
Yes. Truly.
Ricky Mastooks?
Now, asking you to forgive me for even bringing such corrections up to my favorite movie guys, thank you so much for explaining the etymology of the word terrific. There's a line about growing up in South Bend from Philadelphia Story that finally makes sense. Please keep up with discouraging the use of all disjuncts. I happen to be your biggest, mostly silent fan, having only befriended you both as Morocco Mole and DJ Mrs. White on LiveJournal.
Whoa,
and sending you a rescue tape of one of Alonzo's game show appearances when Dave deleted it from TiVo by accident.
Ah, yes.
So this was the guy, Phil.
So you saved our marriage, Phil.
Yeah. In closing, I think you guys are the cat's pajamas.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I'm the bee's knees. You can be the cat's pajamas. I'll be the bee's knees.
You're the one who deleted my game show from TiVo.
You That's guys are the cat's pajamas are. And better than Herbert Hoover put together. That's from Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
Here we go with another letter. We got like three to go.
Oh man, this is turning into the Showa of podcasts.
I'm telling you, dear David Alonso is maybe your only Dutch speaking listener, which says more about our numbers than your reach. I just wanted to clarify a bit of pronunciation. The Dutch IJ sounds like an English long I, so Corbijn rhymes with Gorwine. Mm. Also, the Dutch OE sounds like an English OO, so Verhoeven rhymes with Pershoeven.
So Verhoeven.
Verhoeven. Luckily, neither of these names have that special Dutch phlegm. If you say Van Gogh correctly, it sounds like you're chucking.
Van Gogh.
This probably shouldn't come up that often, as while the Dutch are known for our fantastic cheeses and classical painters, we're not credited with producing many outstanding films or directors.
But we love Paul Verhoeven.
Nogmaals veel bedankt voor uw uitstekende programma.
Wow, I'm sure you completely butchered that.
I'm sure I said it just like a Dutch person would have said it. All the best, Christopher, who lives in Orlando, Florida.
Yes, but is nonetheless Dutch. And I gave you a translation of that. Did you lose it?
What?
That, the sentence in Dutch. I ran it through Babelfish.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know.
Something like, thanks for such a wonderful program.
Oh, okay. Greetings, DNA. Thank you for brightening my every week with your most excellent podcasts.
Oh.
Two to go. This is the penultimate letter.
All right. Da-da-da-ba.
In response to your complainers, may I say that I love listening to all of the seemingly inconsequential and random tangents you often take, which may be unrelated to the cinema, but allows me to get to know you, to hear where you're coming from, and helps me to decide whether I share or trust your opinion. Anyway, imagine what a podcast that would have been if Pauline Kael and John Simon had shared a microphone. Anyway, you two are a hell of a team, always sharp and witty, great job, enough said, here's my list. Dr. Strangelove.
Yay.
Baron Munchausen.
Yes.
The Fabulous World of Jules Verne.
Never saw it.
Me neither. Seven Samurai.
Yep.
Sanjuro, which I have not seen.
I have not seen.
The original Zatoichi films from the 60s, which are all basically the same movie. The DVD extras of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Wait a second. We're moving into digression territory here. The DVD extras for the Alien films, especially number 3.
Wait, so more so than the actual Alien films themselves?
I guess. Mm-hmm. Lots of trash, which I'm sure Dave would enthuse. Awesome. And lastly, John Huston, John Ford, and Howard Hawks. Better films. And a few of their not-so-greats. So this is just sort of a general, vague, generic list. Oh, good. Well, then you're 100% knife because you've only
given us no idea what the hell you're talking
some
about.
Some titles. But there you are, my choices, and that's what makes the film experience, like all art, so personal as well as universal. To each and every one of us, there's something that speaks to us and to which we respond. Ain't life grand? Carry on. That's from Larry. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Your letter was as all over the place as your this list. Podcast.
That too.
Often is.
The last letter.
From Chad. I'm behind in listening to your podcasts. But when I listened to your review of Joe, starring Nicolas Cage, I believe it was Alonso who said something to the effect of he wished Nicolas Cage did good B-movies. Not that I'm going to defend his string of B-level actioners, though they at least have his crazy acting, but what, in your opinion, would constitute a good B-movie for this day and age? Do you have any recommendations that spring to mind from the past decade or so? Of course, what makes the question somewhat difficult is that line between B-movie and mainstream feature that has been blurred over the past couple decades. So, you know, basically, I'm just going to say the Fast and the Furious franchise. Because those are B-movies.
Totally.
But boy, are they great and exciting and have gotten better. Because I started out watching those movies not liking them.
Yeah.
And grew to like them over time. They hooked me eventually.
I would argue that the step-up franchise, which we've been comparing to Fast and Furious. My thing with Nicolas Cage is if he wants to make gut bucket movies, they just should be better gut bucket movies than, you know, Bangkok Dangerous or whatever, or Season of the Witch.
I liked Season of the Witch. Also on the top of a Cage, what did you guys think of 8mm? It's gross!
I never saw it.
personally, I think it's very underrated and actually a pretty creepy film. Well, it is creepy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keep up the good work, Chad.
Thank you, Chad.
We're done. Whew. Thanks for sitting through this whole thing, if you did, in fact, sit through this whole thing.
All right, well, since you were already an Iron Man, I'm going to go ahead and do our usual sign-up. Yes, I skipped it last week, and they're in for a penny, in for a pound.
All the pounds.
As always, we thank Blue for our lovely theme music. You can hear more of his work at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Check out ChristyLemire.com. If you were a SiriusXM listener, check out the Frank DiCaro Show, and Derek and Romaine, listen to our friends in the podcast universe, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, the Schmoes Know, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can review this program at iTunes, and please do, because it does help other people find the show. So if you haven't done it already, we really, really would love for you to go to iTunes and leave us a nice review.
Yeah.
Because it helps more people find the show.
Yes.
You can also subscribe to the show for free at iTunes and download it every week. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com.
Yes.
Or on our Facebook page, Indeed. Linoleum Knife Podcast, which, yes, if you haven't liked yet, please do.
Do it.
You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at TVTag.com.
Promote us on Twitter. Tweet about us.
Our email is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us questions, comments, top 10 lists, funny stories that happened to you in movie theaters. It's also the place you can PayPal us for the things that we are selling. You can PayPal us $20 for a gorgeous linoleum knife t-shirt.
We have like one size large left, I think.
And I think only one double XL left.
No. We have several.
I thought there were. XLs. I think we only had one left.
But we have all the other sizes.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the way up to 2X and.
Yeah, we're out of. I think we're out of 3X.
We're out of 3X and we're almost out of large.
Yeah. So you can PayPal us there, include your size and your shipping address. You can also PayPal us $1.99 for the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife special episodes, where we focus on a movie and you can listen to it while watching the movie or not. And so far we have done Josie and the Pussycats, Clue, Two for the Road, The Apple, and White Christmas, and we will soon be recording. Are we going to tell them yet or no?
Another one soon.
Okay, fine. We'll tell you soon which the next one's going to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all that is happening.
It's going to be until after you get home from Venice. Anyways.
Right, of course. All that's happening at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, visit linoleum-knife.com for links to stuff that we do
elsewhere.
Did you
tell them that there's now a fan page on Facebook?
Oh, right. And, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Go to the Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook. It's a closed group that you can get into. Just let our
initiation.
Yes, our admin will let you in on that.
Gabe.
One. Gabe will make you a member, and it's a place for our fans to talk to each other and talk about movies and talk about stuff in general, whatever you want.
Yeah, it's not a place. I mean, obviously, you could talk about us and how much we're so great,
but we're not forcing.
But it's mostly people talking about movies.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which, why not?
We pop up.
We make appearances.
Yeah.
So,
but we don't run the page.
No. We leave that to Gabe. So thank you for listening as always. Thank you for sharing this program with others and telling people. Thank you for sitting through our longest episode ever.
If you wrote a letter that somehow got lost and you still haven't heard it, we're out of letters. So
resend it, maybe.
So resend it because, you know, sometimes I...
My hope
sometimes
is...
Sometimes I lose things.
My hope is the next time you hear from me, I will be podcasting from Venice, Italy. It's going to be very exciting.
And I will be not.
There you go.
I'll be having a vacation.
So as always, thanks, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.